Tonight on The Download, the director of Goodbye, Christopher Robin, Simon Curtis, celebrity chef Chris Cosentino, and WGN's Bears beat reporter Adam Hogue. Now, here's your host, a man who is thinking about rocking a cowboy hat this winter, Justin Kaufman.
I think that's my new look. I got to be honest with you. Went to Nashville this weekend. Tried out the hats like you do when you go down there. I look like a young Richard Petty. I really did, man. I put that on. It was a Jason Aldean special. He does cowboy hats, Pete. And it was black. I looked tough. You know, if anyone knows me, I'm not so tough. But this made me look tough. And then I could put a flannel on, some boots. I don't know, man. Something to think about. It all started. Hey, let's go into the boots and hats store. This is fun. Oh, hot, look at what. Oh, take a look. I was honestly this close to buying one. My wife was like, "When are you going to wear that?" And I'm like, "I'll wear it every day. I'll wear it on the air. I'll become the talk show cowboy. I'll be up in Chicago with the talk show cowboy."
Larry Lujack always wore a cowboy hat.
See?
You could be the
Chicago,
new Lujack.
New Lujack. Knights. 720, right? A great time, though, in Nashville. I enjoyed it. My cousin Zach got married. Wonderful wedding. I have to say, it was in the Tennessee Hills, right? It was outside, about 30 minutes outside of Nashville. And it was... The backdrop was stunning. If you know the fall in Tennessee, it's just beautiful. It was like right out of a magazine. She came up on a carriage. There was like a horse involved. I was like, I liked my wedding a couple years back. I liked it. You know, it was nice. A church in downtown Chicago was cool. But this was like, I mean, this is right out. This was the scene at the end of Say Yes to the Dress when they picked the dress and then showed the awesome wedding. Like it was HGTV stat. Yeah. It was too good. It was too good. The flowers were autumn leaves, colored leaves instead of flowers. It's pretty great, man. It made me kind of go, you know, I need to get an HGTV producer and see if they can redo the wedding. You know, like I feel like that was the original one, but let's do it again. And this time get it on film. Like I almost became like a producer. I'm like, this is money. This wedding is money. Let's do it again. Let's fake it. It was good, though, man. I was really into it. I really liked it. It was beautiful. Zach and Jessica, congratulations. All right, so we got a great show. Great to be back in Chicago, though. I got so many great... Nashville was fun. I went on Friday night. I went to Broadway, down on Broadway Street. Stood outside. I was with my son, my 10-year-old son. So I didn't really go in the bars, but you can pretty much pick up Sweet Caroline at every turn. I'm like, when did that become a country song? So jacked up to hear country bands at every bar. And it was just Bye Bye Miss American Pie. Yeah, and Sweet Caroline. I'm like, all right, I get it. It's 9-10 o'clock on a Friday night or whatever. And I get it. You're playing to a crowd. But I'm about to buy a cowboy hat. So let's make it happen. You're about to convert me. I'm about to be a convert. I'm about to go all country. And you throw out some Boston Strong. No, ain't going to work. No good. I'm out. I came to my senses. Got in the old rented minivan and got back to Chicago as quick as I could. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We've got an awesome show lined up. Happy to be back in studio right here on Michigan Avenue. We got Studio 435 tonight. Adam Hogue's going to be here. We're going to do the Monday Evening Quarterback. Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy are back with Touche. We've got an awesome show lined up. So stay where you're at. Coming up to carry out. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. All right, here are today's top stories. Governor Rauner announced his bid for re-election this morning. He did it on Twitter and in a video where he's seen riding a Harley. Is that what that was? I didn't know he was a big motorcycle guy. Whenever I see a politician on a hog, I'm always like, I wonder what real motorcycle guys think of that. Rauner's quite the enigma, isn't he? He can ride a hog and pick a $100,000 Merlot to go with it. It's great. Rauner's making the rounds to talk about how he's the right guy to root out corruption and change politics in Springfield. It's the same kind of message he ran on 4 years ago when he won, but not the guy we saw down in Springfield when the state didn't pass a budget for essentially his whole time in office. It almost feels like everyone involved in that embarrassment, both Republicans and Democrats, want to act like it never happened. Or worse, that it wasn't a big deal. That's what kills me. Nah, that's politics. No, it's failure. Rauner's pushing for term limits. I say we go one step further. I say we treat our elected officials like they worked for us at the grocery store. If you don't balance your register, that's a write-up. You don't get shelves stocked, that's another write-up. Three write-ups, you are breaking down box duty. Fourth write-up, clean out your break room cubby. I'm okay with that compromise, right? Both parties, let's do it. Amazon announced today that they got 238 applications from cities looking to host its second headquarters. Chicago was included in that list. 238 different cities. They should do it like an NCAA bracket, right? Or better yet, they should do it like the Olympics where you announce the finalists and then eliminate by rounds. Or, oh, no, better, do it like America's Funniest Videos where you announce a second-place winner first and then it's between the first and the third. I always love that. Anyway, Chicago's not going to get it. We'll get beat by Brazil again or upset by Murray State, one of the two. A huge listeria outbreak is forcing mass recalls on several brands of frozen vegetables. Whew, don't have to worry about that one. I want to bring this news to my doctor and be like, and you told me to cut back on French fries? How dare you? This is what passes for medical information. A new report says that Facebook is testing a new idea of burying select news stories in your newsfeed and only letting them appear if the media company pays for it. Ooh. So essentially, if let's say you're NBC, you'd have to pay a fee to have people see your stuff. That's only the beginning. My prediction? They already own all your stuff. Sooner than later, you'll have to pay to get at your own archives, your own photos. That's my conspiracy theory, and I'm sticking to it. Guarantee that's going to happen. In weather, the weather, you know what? This weather day is usually reserved for Halloween. It's a week early. Climate change is real, y'all. Terrible rainy day. Like I said, the October winds, they're coming up. It could be worse, though. It could be like Siberia, where they only have like 2 hours of light a day. And the rest of it's just nighttime, so I don't know. Think about that. Also, heat wave in L.A. for the World Series. It's going to be over 100 degrees for tomorrow night's game. Ouch. In sports, the Bears won back-to-back games for the first time since 2015. They beat the Panthers at Soldier Field 17-3. The Bears' defense was relentless, took a huge step forward as one of the best defense in the NFL, which is good because the Bears' offense took a smaller step to solidify themselves as the worst. 68 yards on the ground, 100 yards in the air, and some of it, 70 yards of it, was on one play. They had more punts than first downs and prized rookie Mitchell Trubisky threw 7 passes the entire game. When you see a stat line like that that says a QB was 4-7 for 85 yards, you go, man, sucks he got hurt in the first quarter. But to be healthy and play a whole game, that's absurd. That's absurd. But back to the Bears defense. This was the time that we thought we were going to see a Vic Fangio defense, right? Just dominating. And it looked like those old Niner defenses. That was what we thought we were getting when we got Vic Fangio. Now, I've heard the Bears apologists say that the Bears offense is depleted at wide receiver, which is why it's struggling. But last time I looked, the Bears defense was missing Jarrell Freeman, Quinton Demps, and Willie Young. And they held Superman to 0 touchdowns. Come on now. So get off it with the lack of receivers hogwash. The Bears are now 3-4. And with the Packers losing, they look like they might have a chance. Oh, what am I doing? Here we go, right? Oh, they got the Saints next week. The Blackhawks head to Vegas tomorrow for the first ever showdown with the Golden Knights. This expansion team taking the hockey world by storm. They're 6-1. But this will be a huge matchup for them. The Hawks get back to their winning ways after they beat the Coyotes on Saturday. Anyway, this is going to be a great game for all the young Hawks, right? Or at least a great trip. Maybe the game secondary to go and see Love at the Mirage. I don't know. Maybe. Chicago Bulls have kicked off their season with 2 straight losses. Not very competitive, but what do you expect from a team that is the closest thing to a professional tank job? Right, Sam?
I'm just stopping in real quick. I wasn't going to do anything. but you told me before the season we'd do a Bulls preview. Yeah. I am stunned that you didn't want to preview the rebuilding, boxing, kicking the crap out of each other's Chicago Bulls.
They're outmatched pretty much at every position. They boast team chemistry as their biggest strength, even though two of their players are either injured or suspended because of a practice fight.
Remember what John Paxson told you. It's not about winning games. It's about building a culture.
It's hard to be a Bulls fan.
Beat the snot out of each other at practice.
Sam Benyanovich. Always good to see him. I love it. Well, hey, it's funny. I have your name right here. I said, you know, but the Bulls don't have a problem drawing, as Sam Benyanovich has always told us. They continue to be at the top of the league for attendance. So I don't know. This team is 4-32 come January, February. Maybe we don't go to the UC. Maybe we skip the nachos and the T-shirt cannons. Send a message. No? Still going to go? Going to show up at halftime with your sport coat and your fancy skinny jeans? Cool. Cool, Chicago. Cool. College football, the locals have had tough seasons, although good win for Northwestern against Iowa on Saturday. But don't look now. But how about the Fighting Irish? They're ranked number 9 after routing USC. They're 6-1. Big showdown with North Carolina State next week, but they're right in the thick of it with the BCS playoffs. Surprising. Wow. And finally, tonight it was announced that Justin Timberlake will do the halftime show at the Super Bowl. And the NFL also said that they never banned Janet Jackson after the famed wardrobe malfunction 14 years ago, which, of course, was caused by Timberlake. So let me get this one straight. The guy who rips the wardrobe, he's bigger than ever. I'm sorry, but if Timberlake doesn't get Janet Jackson on stage during that performance and let her rip open his parachute pants, then I'm never watching the NFL again. I'm only watching for ripped parachute pants. That's the carryout for October 23rd, 2017. Hey, we're all out of pumpkin spice lattes. We've moved on to cranberry green bean casserole spice lattes. It's an acquired taste. All right, coming up, Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling here. Touche! We haven't had one in a while. Could argue, duke it out over politics. That's coming up here on The Download. Plus, so much more tonight. I'm so excited. Such a great show. Download 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
Welcome back from Nashville. Glad you had a good trip.
Yeah. Oh, y'all, we had a great time.
We had a good time down there.
I loved it, man.
It's a good town.
It's such a good town. Mm-hmm. It was way too much. I went in there on Friday. We were in Murfreesboro. That's where we stayed. That's where the wedding was.
Okay.
So it's about 30 minutes, 25 minutes from Nashville. Mm-hmm. So we went in on Friday night with the family to be like, oh, let's go check it out. It was like 17 Festival of Lights on Michigan Avenue were happening. I mean, there was so much happening. There was rerouted. You had to park like miles away. Like, it was a hard town to get down to. Because at the end of the day, it's a pretty small town. It's not. But I'm telling you, man, it was really hard. The town was way packed. Like, you do 9 o'clock on a Friday night, forget about it.
Well, it's dense. That area you're talking about. I mean, it's fun, but you got to be prepared.
Got to be prepared for walk. I had some of my relatives with. And, you know, I was like, me, I could park, you know, I'd park 40 blocks away. I'm okay. But I was just like, I was that guy. I was a driver. I was like, we got to get close enough, you know. Uncle Kelly, he's got to walk. You know, how are we going to get there? Maybe we park right on. Can I double park right here on Broadway?
Well, that's a sign of our age, too.
Yeah.
I find myself getting closer and closer to things.
Exactly. I feel like you just keep rounding.
I think there's two.
Let's try one more time.
Aiden, stick your head out. Spot two spaces up there? I got you. Don't worry. I'll hold you by your belt.
Yeah, it was a good time.
Good.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché.
You go right, you go left, you go left.
Yeah, there we go. Look who's back in studio. Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy.
Monday.
The stars of Touche.
Here again, here at last.
Our great segment we do every Monday at 7:30 here.
How long has it been?
It's been a couple weeks since you and I have been together. Yeah.
It's good to see both of you. Thanks for being here. Of course, Dave and Chris, both a
here.
Democrat and a Republican, are ready to spar over the issues of the day, both nationally and here in the state of Illinois. But why don't we start at the national level? Why don't we start with the budget and tax reform. We saw this story. I mean, there's a lot. Today, the news was completely dominated by, reaction to what happened in Niger, to everything down the line from how Trump
but we've
has.
We've got to talk about Rauner.
Well, we're going to. We're going to.
But going
I think the bigger story to me is tax reform. Where are we on this? Because I've seen it both ways that this is a done deal.
Dave, you oppose tax reform.
It's a done
are.
Deal, no, but I'll also talk. At the same time, if it doesn't get done, it's trouble.
Big, bold program. You need 51 votes to get it through the Senate. It's going to fly through the United States House of Representatives. And I think it's going to unleash the U.S. economy. I think it's going to unleash the economy. And frankly, this one, I never said this about healthcare. I believe this one is going to get done. It's going to get signed, and it is going to unleash the economy, and we are going to have a bang up 2018.
Dave.
You know, Justin, everything old is new again. And I noticed the other day Donald Trump sent out a tweet in which he said that he quoted Arthur Laffer.
Great guy.
Trickle-down economics.
No, he's not.
He absolutely was.
No, he's not.
Inventor of the Laffer Curve.
Exactly
Can
wrong.
Can you actually let me speak? He quoted Reagan's economist, Arthur Laffer, and said, a Democrat would be a fool to turn down these tax cuts. And here's the thing. When this was all starting, it was about, quote, tax reform. You were going to restructure the U.S. tax code. Now it's just tax cuts.
That's not true. We've seen this again and again.
And by the way, the trickle-down economics doesn't unleash the U.S. economy. It never has. It never will. You put money in the hands of middle-class people, that's how you unleash the economy.
Well, we'll see.
We've seen several times.
No, I'm sorry, David. You forget your basic course in economics. There's something called national income accounting. There's consumer spending, government spending, receipts from exports. Yeah, you fall asleep. You never learned economics because you fell asleep in class. And there is, most importantly, business investment. This is going to repatriate. I think forward-looking Democrats like John Delaney from Maryland, for instance, have devoted a lot of time to studying this issue of expatriated earnings overseas that are not coming back
by
American
That's
companies
a big deal, right.
that throughout 8 years of Obama, they could never get it together to figure out a way to get that money back here and go to work for the American economy. David doesn't care because he likes government dependence.
You are conflating again.
No,
if you want to talk about repatriation, you'll get bipartisan agreement by Democrats and Republicans.
Excuse me,
but that
is
not the highlight of this plan. The highlight of this plan is a massive tax cut for the wealthy.
So you say it's a $4,000 tax cut for the average American taxpaying family. And number two about tax reform, you are going to see something between 87.3 and 91.9% of all filers, and there are only about, 60% of American families who file, but of those, almost all are going to get down to one page, if not a postcard. But I do want to go back to this trillions of dollars. Delaney, very thoughtful, very serious, very successful guy, pegged this at about $3 trillion that's overseas. It may be as much as more than $5 trillion. It hasn't come back. David wants to say it's a tax cut. In fact, it is reform because we are changing our entire corporate structure to bring that money back and go to work for the American worker.
Who loses in this? Because to listen to Chris, everybody's going to get a tax cut. We're all going to get our money back and the economy's going to go wild. But
wow.
I've seen more and more articles about middle class not getting the pay that your deductions are a huge part, especially when it comes to being able to deduct your property taxes, a local state. It almost feels like a poke in the eye to blue states, big cities like New York, Chicago, San Francisco, L.A.
Well, first, let's be clear about one thing. There is no plan yet, per se. There are concepts. There are trial balloons that get floated out. So, for example, last Friday, a trial balloon was floated out that we're going to cut down the amount of money that could be put into 401ks from $18,000 a year to $2,400 a year. That would devastate middle-class families. There was a huge uproar. It was instantly, and Donald Trump today said, oh, no, we're not going to do that.
He's putting the trial balloon out to see
what they're throwing
sticks,
all kinds of trial balloons out to see what sticks. One of the ones that you were referring to.
Did you want it to go to 24, or did you want it to stay?
No.
Okay, so what are you upset about? What the heck are you upset about?
I'm upset because
he's not doing it, and you're trying to act like he's wrong.
Your party in Congress focuses on the wealthy.
You know, you cannot find your way through an economic conversation.
What are you talking about?
You
it's
just
your
said you don't.
Proposal.
You said you didn't want it to happen. It's not happening.
Yeah,
and
but it's kind of what
they wanted
it
to
happen.
Why is he upset?
Oh, my God. Through the Looking Glass.
You owe me an ice cream
Ladies
cone.
And gentlemen, welcome to Through the Looking Glass with Chris Roebling. This is the problem. Republicans' motivations are all about helping the wealthy. It's not about helping the middle class.
Untrue.
And if this does that, also, what happened to the Republican fiscal conservatives? Because when fiscal conservatism would say you don't add $1.5 trillion to the deficit, Mick Mulvaney, the ultimate fiscal conservative, is now like, it's
what's amazing is these half baked arguments have been in the oven so long they're still only half baked. Now I want to tell you,
yes, trickle down economics, half baked.
David, what I am going to tell you is this: you have,
I'm waiting.
Well.
All of WGA listeners in 38 states are waiting for your brilliance.
We are reducing the number of tax brackets. We are easing the tax burden on people. We're making it easier to file. If anybody wants to, you ask who's going to lose out.
Yeah.
I mean, the H&R Blocks, God bless him, you know, Henry Block and his brother and all
that
these other.
That industry is going to be.
That whole industry is going to be devastated because this is going to pass. And notwithstanding David's purely political results. No, I mean, this. And by the way, 1986 was not bad. But 1981 was fantastic, and we are going to see this.
Which is why
year.
Reagan increased taxes 8 more times right. after that, because he cut them too far.
God, David.
David Lundy,
these
Chris Roebling.
I'm sorry. The fact is the Democrats pledged on paper in public to cut spending, and Reagan believed them, and they welched.
Oh, please.
The touche 1983 version we've got going on right here. Dave and Chris, let's take a quick break. Come back. You want to do local?
Rauner.
Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
Touche. Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy in studio. We are talking Touché. Politics as we do every Monday night here. I'm talking. Argument. You know, it's
we
it's
are talking
over.
We never stopped during the break either.
We didn't stop.
No, we didn't.
If folks watching on the little cam, do those work?
WGNradio.com. Yeah.
On the commercials?
No, they don't work on the commercials. Oh. They would have seen heated arguments between the two of you.
Yes. No, right. I mean, okay. So
and Chris is
it.
Still wrong.
What's your book there? What's your book?
This is
there?
For later. I've got Chef Chris Cosentino in. So Offal Good. It's about Offal. It's about eating organs. All right, let's get to Rauner. Today he announces his reelection. He's on the tour. He's talking about rooting out corruption in Springfield and bringing change to the climate in Springfield. Acting as if the last 4 years haven't happened.
So, oh, my God. It is so sad. You know, on corruption, I mean, just take one look at this whole Nancy Kimmy scandal. But forget about that. I had the privilege of writing something for PrairieStateWire.com.
Dan Prof propaganda arm.
Prairie State Wire. Dan Prof had nothing to do with me writing this. I wrote it on my own. I don't know what the hell you're talking. Once again, a false statement from Dave Lundy.
No, Dan Prof owns Prairie State Wire and 23 other propaganda.
Sorry. What did you write, Chris?
I wrote a statement that Rauner's damaged goods, that he lied to everybody over HB 40, that he came down on the wrong side of a variety of issues, such as transgender birth certificates, such as sanctuary state, such as his personification of the problems of the state of Illinois in the individual Michael Madigan, as opposed to advancing a sound legislative strategy to try to win on something somewhere and put some proverbial points on the board. And I don't think that he has enough, really, to justify running. And in fact, I think he's done so poorly with the Republican base, he cannot win in November of 2018.
I've heard this a couple times today, and I don't know if I necessarily believe it. This idea that conservative Republicans in the state of Illinois will turn their back at the general election. If Bruce Rauner gets through any sort of primary challenge, that they would pick politics over party. In this case, and that they would turn their back and just not show up to the polls to support Governor Rauner.
State over party.
I think that there will be a lot of conservatives who do skip the ballot. I mean, I will tell you that there in 1998, I could not vote for our party's nominee, Glenn Pichard, and I could not vote for George Ryan because I knew he was a crook. So I literally skipped the race and just voted in everything else. It's not that I didn't vote. I just didn't vote for
and
that
race. And your guy lost. Pichard lost.
He did lose. And so,
Thing is coming up.
I think that there is going to be an element of that. But the idea that that Jeannie Ives is going to beat Bruce Rauner in a primary, I think is ridiculous. It's not going to happen. I think that if anybody actually challenges him ultimately in a primary, it's just going to be a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing. They'll get 30%, just like T.O. Hardeman got 30% when he ran against Pat Quinn 4 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand the betrayal on SB 40. But the other stuff you're talking about, I mean, he didn't run as a conservative Republican. He ran
saying, I have no social agenda and I will harm neither side. That's what he said, and he didn't serve that way. And I believe all sides are pretty much upset with him over that. But most importantly, he hasn't improved anything. He had great promise as a, private equity sort of master
investor,
of the universe type guy. And he had great sort of promise for understanding the dynamics of our budget disaster after 12 years of unrestricted Democratic rule in which nothing was done to improve the state. Everybody was just paying off the unions who run the Democratic Party. And so he comes in and says,
it's the name of the party platform.
I understand how to fix Illinois because I'm a finance guy. He gets in there and within about, 38 minutes of taking the oath of office, he says all of the problems in Illinois begin and end with Mike Madigan, which was, petty and personal and utterly political. And it was non-policy oriented. And the whole point on our side of the aisle is there are a lot of different, better policies that are being instituted in Wisconsin, in Indiana, in Michigan, in Iowa, all over the country. Illinois falls farther and farther behind because there are no proponents of those in the governor's office. And because our governor then compounds that problem by personalizing everything. And so I don't think I disagree with David. I mean, I agree with him about November, but I don't think Rauner will make it to November. I think Jeannie Ives beats Rauner on announcement.
Yeah, wow. I don't. But look, let's be clear about something. Bruce Rauner, I agree with Chris. Bruce Rauner is a failed governor. Bruce Rauner came into town. He attacked all unions, not just public employee unions, which united the union movement in the state like it hasn't been united before. And then he personalized everything to Madigan, and he got literally nothing done, which is why his video that his announcement video today, which is beautiful, pretty pictures, a lot of great visuals, by the way, many of which were copied from the video he did 4 years ago. But he says in the punchline of the video is that, and that's why I'm here to fight. It's as if he hasn't been in office for 3 years. It's like it's his first go at it. And it's like, yeah, you're fighting. That's all you're doing. You're not getting anything done.
I will ask the question, how powerful is the message that Madigan caused this mess? I mean, do Republican voters say, yeah, I don't want to. I mean, the one constant that's been there for 10, 15, 25 years has been Mike Madigan.
Yeah,
do Republicans
say,
it doesn't matter if it's Bruce Rauner. It doesn't matter who it is. Let's try to get him out.
There are some activists in the party who are going after 9 or 10 seats in the Illinois House of Representatives where they think they might be able to win enough of those seats to depose Mike Madigan. I wish them luck. I hope they win. I'm not sure. I think it's whenever you do one of these 9-seat deals, you might end up winning 6 or 7, but it's very tough to win all of them.
Particularly in 2018 when Democratic voters in the state of Illinois, which is we are more Democratic than Republican, really want to stick it to Trump and they really want to stick it to Republicans. So there's a huge headwind for Republicans going into the 2018 elections, and that's going to have an effect with state reps and state senators up and down the ballot.
So the Madigan thing, I think, was always petty. It was always personal, and it was never policy-based. He didn't turn it into a policy discussion. He kept it at some sort of personal thing.
Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, I like when we talk about Trump, you guys get more fired up. Rauner, you're on the same page. That's never fun. That's not what Touche's all about.
Come on.
Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling, Touche. Good to see you guys.
See you.
That's it. The Chicago Bears have matched last season's win total. Third victory of the season for Chicago. The Carolina Panthers lose to Chicago 17-3. John Fox gets the win against his former team.
time for the Monday Evening Quarterback here on the download. 312-981-7200. The Chicago Bears win their second game. Back-to-back wins, the first time since 2015. They're now, like you just heard, matched the season total from last year in wins. They sit at 3-4. The name of the game, defense. Unbelievable. The relentless pressure and opportunity. I mean, it was amazing to watch the nonstop rush, pass rush of the Chicago Bears, which obviously helped the secondaries. Eddie Jackson, the rookie safety, had a tremendous game, returning a fumble and an interception for touchdowns, the only touchdowns of the game. But the question is, on the other side of the ball, the Chicago Bears offense sputters. Rookie sensation? Question mark. Mitchell Trubisky had 7 attempts. I should say that's a little bit misleading in the sense that he had 13 attempts, but 7. He was 4 for 7 for 85 yards. Not a great showing, and really setting records in futility for the Chicago Bears offense. But a win is a win. Do we like winning ugly? 312-981-7200. I do not. Adam Hoge, WGN Radio, covers the Bears. You can find all his great stuff at WGNRadio.com/Bears, is with us now for the Monday Evening Quarterback. Adam, great to have you here. Lots to talk about, so why don't we get right to it. The Bears, back-to-back wins. This was something that we didn't necessarily see coming.
Yeah, I mean, although I did end up picking the Bears in this game, and I actually had them winning 30-20 relatively comfortably, but a lot of that had to do with the Panthers and kind of their current situation with injuries and Cam Newton being erratic, and I think a lot of that we saw in this football game. But, Justin, you don't like winning?
A win is a win, Adam. You got to win in the NFL, right?
So here's what I'll last week I kind of defended the offensive game plan with you. I'll bring up some concerns I have this time around. And a lot of it, if I've had frustrations with the offense, it hasn't necessarily been the play calling. A lot of it's been personnel. You know, why isn't this guy getting, why isn't Kendall Wright playing more when he's clearly the best wide receiver? Why did Tariq Cohen only get 7 snaps yesterday? And then the other thing I'll say, and this is really, it doesn't necessarily have to go with the play calling as much as just personnel groupings. They're starting to become a little predictable on offense, too. When Tariq Cohen's on the field only 7 times, and then most of those times when he's on the field, you're targeting him or giving him the ball in some ways, well, that kind of tips off the defense, right?
Yeah.
And teams go into deep dives on studies and play tendencies, and it's all on the scouting report every single week. So at some point, they're going to have to get a little bit more creative with the personnel that they have.
You know, I do enjoy winning. There's no doubt about it. And having a Bears team that is more competitive is good for not just for me, but for the city and everything in between. But this is winning ugly in a way that Chicago Bears offense didn't. I mean, it was an embarrassment. It's a joke that only 7 attempts. The running game was non-existent. The offensive line didn't make any room for anybody. The offense was pretty bad. I mean, like a lot more punts than first downs. This is stuff that you see when you get blown out of a game, yet the Bears won.
Well, until the final few minutes of the game, the defense had just as many takeaways as the offense had first downs in this game. So, yeah, it was tough to watch offensively. There's no question about it. Some of that had to do with, again, the philosophy that we talked about last week, and I don't think that's going to change. If the Bears jump out to a 2-possession lead, they're going to shut things down offensively. They don't want to give the ball away. And you saw it against the Ravens a week ago. I mean, Tariq Cohen did have a fumble. And even in this game, Mitch Trubisky was lucky that he didn't have a pass picked off in the second half when he overthrew Zach Miller. So they're just trying to avoid those disastrous situations, and they don't really care how ugly it looks.
I guess, but my question, Adam, is that if you're up 2 scores, isn't that the time for the disaster? I mean, so many times we've seen them when they're down 2 scores and Jay Cutler throws a pick 6 and there's the disaster we've all been waiting for. In this case, don't we want to see Mitchell Trubisky in an aggressive stance when he has the opportunity to make a mistake? That's my only issue with shutting down the game and going to punt formation to try and win. We're not going to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, but John Fox is trying to save his job, and ultimately he needs wins. So I think that has something to do with it. However, I think, and he probably knows this, I mean, the development of Mitch Trubisky is probably just as important as wins at this point. And if the front office decides that what John Fox is doing with his philosophy isn't helping Trubisky, well, then that's going to have just as much say on whether or not he gets a contract extension yeah. or is let go at the end of this season. But I'm not sure that they have a problem with this. I mean, I do remember Ryan Pace didn't want to be playing Trubisky right now. So if they're going to be conservative and take it easy and try to let him see as many defenses as possible and just sort of go through the motions a little bit to start his career, I don't think they hate that idea. I'll tell you what, I didn't think Trubisky was all that bad. I didn't think he was great, but he should have finished 6-7. Tariq Cohen had a couple drops in this game, including a great back shoulder throw that Mitch threw him that he just didn't turn his head around in time. So four completions looks bad. I didn't think Trubisky did have a couple mistakes. You can't take a sack to knock you out of field goal range. Right. That can't happen. But the other sacks I thought were not really his fault. You brought it up earlier. The offensive line didn't play well in this game. And I thought that was the – if we're going to criticize anything with this offense, it should be that.
And I will say, I made the argument last week that the numbers were deceiving. With Jordan Howard's 167 yards, he ran the ball 36 times, and he ran it one in overtime for 50 yards. That skewed the numbers. But again, on the offensive line, where they're just not opening up any holes. Now, maybe that has to do with the defensive stack in the box, but then you would think that you have this young quarterback that's mobile that can get out and make them pay for doing that. It just seems more often than not that John Fox and Dowell Loggins are using Mitch Trubisky like a backup quarterback. And I know he is, but the point being that that's not essentially what the fans want to see.
That's a great way to put it.
Glennon got hurt, and now we've got Trubisky. He's the Craig Krenzel of 2017. And I don't think anybody in Chicago wants to see that. That's not what we bought in on Ryan Pace, trading picks and moving up and making an exciting move to get this quarterback. He's playing, whether you like it or not. Unleash him. That's my thought. We got a lot to talk about tonight. 312-981-7200. I also want to say it's unfair that we spend so much time on I've been so down on the Bears 2 weeks in a row with wins. Let's come back after the break and talk about this defense, because if there was one shining moment that we will remember from this season, it was the performance of that front. I mean, everybody. I mean, from Eddie Jackson to Leonard Floyd, they showed the potential they showed what we've been waiting to see in a Vic Fangio defense. Adam Hoge, WGNRadio.com/Bears. You can find all his stuff there. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and we'll get at the defense. Stay with us.
3rd and 10 for Carolina. Floyd is back on the field for Chicago. Early stages, second quarter. Newton popped up in the air. Intercepted. Eddie Jackson. Jackson is still going. Another defensive highlight. Touchdown, Bears.
Yeah, it was something else to watch the Chicago Bears defense bring two balls back to the house, fumble return and a fumble recovery and return, and a pick six from Eddie Jackson, the rookie safety. Good day for the rookie class for Ryan Pace. Adam Hoge on the line, WGNRadio.com/Bears. Of course, you can read all of his great stuff. He covers the Bears for the station. Let's talk about this defense. That was what we expected with the hire of Vic Fangio, right? I mean, that was the idea. Everything about that with the two outside linebackers, Leonard Floyd being able to track Cam Newton down, bend not break, but at the same time blitzing. I mean, just out physical. I mean, they were just punching the Panthers in the mouth. That was the best defensive performance I've seen the Chicago Bears do in 4 years, 5 years.
They got some swagger, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I love it.
They're playing with an attitude right now, and it's very impressive. That comes with confidence, and it really, I think, is exuding itself in a player like Kyle Fuller that all of a sudden is just he's the guy they drafted for number 14 overall 4 years ago. But it's starting to come together for him now that he's healthy and he's getting some confidence. That's what you want to see. You know, the one thing that's popping out on film to me, and even just live when you're watching the games, they're fast. Yeah. They got some speed, and that's what it's all about in the NFL, especially on defense. You have to have speed, and these are all, other than Kyle Fuller, these are all guys that Ryan Pace brought in here. You're seeing it with Eddie Jackson, Adrian Amos. When you have confidence, you play faster. Danny Trevathan is just shooting gaps, and he's got the speed. Leonard Floyd coming off the edge. Yes. And then Eddie Goldman and Akeem Hicks, I say it every single week, as long as those two are healthy, opposing offensive lines can't can't stop them. They're just too big. You cannot stop everybody on that front. If those two are in, they're eating up two blockers at a time.
It seemed that the Chicago Bears' game plan on the defensive side of the ball centered around stopping Christian McCaffrey. He every time he touched the ball, a linebacker was on him putting a whack on him. You know, because they did some stuff, as screen passes, maybe a draw, maybe a little flip out, whatever it might be. But it just seemed that the pursuit of the linebacking core for this game, you saw that they did everything they can to just guess right on the Carolina Panthers offense.
And it helps when you have versatile guys like Leonard Floyd who can cover a guy like that, right? I mean, he's an edge rusher, but he's, you know, if you go back and watch his tape from Georgia, they line him up as a slot corner sometimes. And he would cover small wide receivers and run with them down the field. So that's what they loved with Leonard Floyd. Now, he didn't cover McCaffrey the whole game. I thought Vic Fangio did a good job of changing that up, kind of keeping the Panthers guessing. Sometimes it was Christian Jones. Sometimes you had a safety on him. It was a great game plan of taking that playmaker out of the game. And then meanwhile, you saw the secondary shut down a couple good wide receivers, too. So just an all-around great performance with the Bears defense.
Well, Eddie Jackson will get the highlights, of course, for the two pick sixes, which is really about being in the right place, you know, getting that opportunity and going. It wasn't like he made huge plays on the ball. But I will say that I thought, I mean, when you think of Leonard Floyd and drafting him in the top 10 last year, and everyone's saying, well, he's undersized, can he make it in the NFL? Watching him be able to harass and you know, track Cam Newton down from behind when he's rolling out and do all the things that most linebackers in this league cannot do. It was really impressive, and you see why Leonard Floyd especially can be an elite talent in the NFL.
Well, you're seeing him convert speed to power, which is something his old his outside linebackers coach, Clint Hurt, who's no longer with the team, but I remember talking to him about this last year in training camp when Leonard Floyd was just a rookie and kind of sort of struggling to adjust to the NFL and the much bigger players, much stronger players he was facing just in practice. And the whole thing was, look, he's not the strongest guy, but he has speed, he has crazy athleticism, and there's a way to get offensive linemen off balance if you can use that speed and convert it to power, which is something he's doing right now with his hands, and it's
Purnell McPhee does that very well too.
Yeah, Purnell, and that's another thing. Purnell is playing pretty well.
Yeah,
and I have to be honest, I with his knee issues, and he's got issues with both of his knees. I was not expecting a whole lot from him right now. You know, it's nice when you have a rotation of guys, but they've taken a hit with Willie Young being out. They lost Lamar Houston before the season even started, but they're still, you know, Purnell's been able to play more than I thought and play at a higher level than I thought.
I thought it was very telling that, you know, we've heard this over and over, and we'll talk about it tonight as well, but this idea that the, you know, the wide receivers are hurt or playmakers on the offense are hurt, and that's part of the reason that they don't trust Mitchell Trubisky. But this defense has been decimated as well. Starting safety, Quinton Demps. You have Willie Young, as you just mentioned. Jarrell Freeman. And Nick Kukowski is backup, both out. I mean, there was 2 weeks ago where we're like, we don't even know who's going to be in uniform. And this defense is able to come together with the chemistry they have right now. And I don't know if it's Vic Fangio dialing up more blitzes, which was, I read a stat that this was the most blitz game of the year so far. But whatever it is, it seemed like this unit so far was the most gelled unit that we've seen from a Bears defense.
Well, a couple of things have happened, and this was the most blitzes Vic Fangio has called this season. But so many teams are too quick to pull the trigger on rebuilds, not given enough patience, right? And so what you're seeing here this year is a couple years of talent acquisition cycles start to come together with what they call depth, which is so important. And last year, guys got hurt, and they didn't have depth. Well, this year, they've gone through three different layers of depth at the inside linebacker position, and Christian Jones has been around, and he's seen enough now. He has enough experience, and when he doesn't have to relay the defensive signals, he's just able to go play football, which is what he does well. So when he's out there with Danny Trevathan, that's a perfect example. And then, honestly, you know, Adrian Amos makes a couple plays, gets some confidence. He's been way better than Quinton Demps. That turned out to be an upgrade after that injury. So when you have depth, you took a starter last year in Adrian Amos who wasn't quite playing at high enough level. You bring in a veteran, you push him a little bit more, you threaten his job security. The same thing happened with Kyle Fuller when you sign two veterans off the street to come in and you hand them the starting jobs right away. Well, these young guys, they start to go, well, I better get my butt in gear. And for Kyle Fuller and Adrian Amos, it has turned them into better football players.
Let me ask you this. If I'm the New Orleans Saints and I'm the offensive coordinator, I'm Sean Payton, and that's who the Bears play next week, what are you looking at? What's the weak point of this Bears defense? After they showed up this week and annihilated Cam Newton, what are some of the things you saw on tape, Adam, and said, well, we could have success here?
Well, if you are able to give the quarterback time, and Drew Brees has a knack for, I mean, he's older now, but he still has enough mobility to create throwing windows and escape sacks. The one thing I didn't like, especially in the first half yesterday, was how many third down conversions the Bears gave up. And that's any defense. If you give a quarterback time, then eventually someone's going to get open. So that's really the key, but I it's a great question. I don't know that there is a giant weakness right now. A couple weeks ago, I would have said the secondary, yeah, but now look great.
Well, does Fangio, does he have to stay with this idea of blitzing? I mean, do we just going to see a blitz-happy Chicago Bears defense? Because they have the speed, and when they're disrupting Cam Newton, he couldn't go downfield. He was taking sacks or checking down. I mean, is that the recipe for success for this defense, is to bring him and bring him often?
Well, it's a week-by-week thing, and you have to be careful being too predictable. And the Saints have kind of developed a decent running game this year. They drafted Kamara from Tennessee that's turned into a pretty good pick for them. So I think that the one thing, the benefit that they had against the Panthers on Sunday was that their running game is really not all that great.
Yeah.
So I think this is a little bit of a different challenge this week with the Saints. You have to be a little bit more worried about that. When you're not worried about the run, you can kind of pin your ears back and get after the quarterback more. So things are going to change week to week, but when you have layers of defense and your defensive line is playing well, your linebackers are playing well, and your secondary is playing well, well, that just gives you so much versatility and allows you to be unpredictable, which creates takeaways. And that's what we've seen the last 2 weeks with the Bears coming up with six of them.
Amazing. 312-981-7200. All right, we'll take a break. We'll get an update on Rob's news. And when we come back, Adam and I will take your calls and texts. But we'll also talk, I want to talk about Mitchell Trubisky. We already kind of talked about him at the beginning. But also about Ryan Pace and where we're at with this team after, 7 weeks now, where the rookie class was much maligned. I mean, this was one that everyone said, well, what a terrible grade. We are seeing production out of these players in the starting roles. I mean, Eddie Jackson and Mitchell Trubisky, plus a couple others. But we'll also talk about the glaring weaknesses to this team, which is the wideout position, which I'm not even sure where we're at with that. Adam Hogue covers the Bears for WGN Radio, and he will be back with the Monday evening quarterback right after the break. Stay with us.
From the 25, 3:18 to play, first half. Deep drop, Trubisky. Trubisky airs it out. Separation, looking for Cohen. He's got it! Tariq Cohen cutting to the outside. Cohen's got major speed, and he's tripped up. Kevon Seymour saves a touchdown, but a big play downfield, rookie to rookie, for 70 yards.
It's a good place to start for the second half of the Monday evening quarterback here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Adam Hogue, WGNRadio.com/Bears, all his great stuff. He is with us every Monday after the Bears game on Sunday to break down the game, but also get your thoughts. 312-981-7200. The texts are lining up. Adam, why don't we start right there? That play, which came after the Bears had a lead, showed us all what Mitch Trubisky could do, hitting Tariq Cohen, got us down first and goal, and then we watched the Bears inch out three different plays and not be able to get in the end zone. And John Fox decides to go for the field goal. What's your take on that drive right there? Because that was something that was a little bit perplexing for us, hoping to see the Bears get offense get in the end zone.
It's funny because the coach's film is finally available to me in the last hour, and I literally just watched that drive while we were in the news break there. So, first of all, it's a great play design on the long hit to Trubisky, from Trubisky to Cohen. because the Panthers have a single high safety back, and the tight end Deion Sims comes across and kind of brings that the safety with him, so that left Cohen on one-on-one coverage, and Cohen was basically just a slot receiver in this game. He didn't even get a carry at running back. So if he can beat corners one on one, then that shows that he has an ability to be a wide receiver. And as soon as Trubisky saw the safety go with Sims, he launched the ball downfield. It was actually slightly over underthrown.
Yeah.
Trubisky felt like he could, if he let him perfectly, it would have been a touchdown. But it was still a great play. But then a few plays later, you see another play design that just didn't work. They put Tariq Cohen in kind of an end around situation in motion, and they faked the handoff to him. They kind of sent the whole offensive line to the right side with Cohen, and the Panthers just didn't buy it. So they brought in Mizell, who had not played at all yet this season. He was somebody they brought in from the Ravens right as the season started, and he started on the practice squad. So they brought him into the game, and they were obviously trying to catch the Panthers off guard with a new player, and were hoping the defense would go with Cohen, and it just didn't work. They didn't bite on it. So Trubisky decided to tuck the ball and try to beat Julius Peppers to the pylon, which just didn't work. Tanner Gentry came open late on that play, but at that point, Trubisky had already made the decision to tuck the ball.
And then, obviously with the review on that play, you have a fourth down on the goal line. Some might say, why not go for it in that case? I heard Roe talking about that. I mean, why not see what the Bears might be able to do there and put away the Panthers for good?
You know what? I actually liked John Fox's answer to this, which was, tried something on first down, it didn't work. Tried something on second down, it didn't work. Tried something on third down, it didn't work. So what makes you think it would have worked on fourth down? Maybe just some honesty that he doesn't really trust his offense right now. You know what? Actually, all these situations are different, and most times I would say you're inside the one, you go for it, because worst case scenario is they get the ball inside the 1 yard line, and you have a great defense that can maybe create a safety out of that situation. But you know what? At this point, you're up 14-3. I like the decision to make it 17-3. It didn't look like the Panthers were going to have any success offensively, so I would have been happy with it either way, I think, but I didn't mind the field goal in that spot.
It brings us back to the issue of trust for John Fox and Dowell Loggins, and maybe they don't trust their quarterback, but it also doesn't feel like they trust the offense. In the way that's a perfect example of a situation in which the coach, even honestly, after the fact on the podium, says that he doesn't. I mean, this idea that the Bears are only going to go as far as they let them. In a way that, these are professional ball players. There's a lot of talent, of course, with Mitchell Trubisky, he's a rookie. But do you get the sense that the coaching staff trusts this team and trusts the players that are on the field?
Not on offense. No, I don't. I think a lot of it has to do with the lack of wide receivers. And it's, this is a tough spot that Trubisky's entering into. And they had to make the move. No one's disagreeing that. He should be out there. I like that he's learning on the fly. But let's go back to a play we talked about early on in the hour, which was when he took the sack on third down that pushed the Bears back out of field goal range. And that was they tried the 52-yarder, but Barth's kick just barely got nicked and it ended up hitting the crossbar, falling short. That's just a sack you don't want to take. You can't push. When you're in that spot, you have to at least stay in field goal range. But if you look at what happened on that play, Trubisky's first read was to a wide receiver downfield, and it wasn't there. The guy wasn't open. Now, he missed Zach Miller. Zach Miller was open underneath, and I actually just tweeted out the screenshot of that moment where it actually looked like Trubisky looked Miller's way. I don't know if he was worried about the defensive lineman in front of him getting his hands up or whatever, but he didn't pull the trigger. So that goes to show you that Trubisky's still working some things out. It's not all his fault. The wide receiver didn't get open on the play, but you got to hit your tight end underneath, and it would have been a first down. And he didn't pull the trigger. He ends up taking the sack. So that's just a learning experience. Those plays are going to happen with a rookie quarterback no matter how good he is.
Your article that's on WGNradio.com/Bears right now, Trubisky had an interesting quote, which I guess as a football fan I don't think about it this way. But when he talks about the idea that there were pass plays called But he said, we have more pass plays called. I was just pulling them down, being conservative and taking sacks. I was just trying to play smart, protect the football, and get out of here with a win. So in a lot of ways, there are, you know, the stat sheet's going to show 4 of 7, but he did drop back a couple more times, and he purposely, you know, because he's being coached that way, he's like, he is not going to make a mistake, and he just took the sack.
There's no question that they are coaching him to be conservative and as safe as possible. But at the same time, it's a fine line because you don't want the quarterback to be too afraid to make a mistake. But there's certain situations where you can take a risk. And there was another interesting quote he had last week. Actually, it was either Dowell or Mitch who said this. I think it was Dowell Loggins, the offensive coordinator. On the play in overtime last week against the Ravens, where it was a situation where they had to get the first down and they were going to be punting, Dowell said he actually told Mitch in his headset before the play, hey, don't be afraid to take a risk here. Because, you know, if he throws an interception there, at least they're back in their own territory. It's not the end of the world. Right. And they needed a play. So, he gets that message in his head, don't be afraid to take a risk. And you saw the end result. He made an incredible play, avoiding the pressure, throwing off his back foot, and delivering a strike to Kendall Wright in a huge moment. So, there's no question, I think, that he's afraid to make some mistakes. That's probably why he didn't pull the trigger on that Zach Miller throw that I just talked about, because that's a different situation. But at the same time, the guy was open, so you got to make the throw. And that's just things he's going to – every game, he's only played 3 games.
Yeah, yeah.
So we got to be patient, too, as hard as this is to watch sometimes.
Well, I get it. I want to make sure that John Fox, Dowell Loggins, they aren't coaches that are like, do exactly what we tell you and don't make a mistake, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. And make sure that, you know, he's not waiting for that Dowell Loggins thing in his ear that says, now you can take a risk. And then he makes the play that we all want him to make. You know, I hope at some point or another he gets – moving on past that, because he only had 7 attempts. I mean, when you're 4 of 7 and there's chuckles on the SportsCenter stage, you know, when you're watching the NFL wrap up on Sunday and they throw the stat up and the SportsCenter analysts all chuckle at the Bears' futility. Is there any – I mean, it's a win, right? We won the game, 3-4, but it doesn't come with respect for Mitchell Trubisky. It doesn't come respect for the Bears offense that mustered up less than 200 yards, didn't get in the end zone. Is there any negative psychological impact? These guys all pay attention to social media. They know what's happening. Do they recognize that it's a win, but it's also pretty ugly?
You know, I think so, but in Trubisky's case, that really does not seem to bother him. And I think we saw that during the whole Mike Glennon saga. I never fully believe players when they say that they don't pay attention to the outside noise. I think there's just human nature to pay attention a little bit. But I don't get the sense that it affects him at all. And the thing is I was driving home last night from the stadium. I was thinking to myself, there's probably going to be a lot of out-of-town stupid here on Trubisky, which is just people who don't watch every play. And I don't blame them. I don't watch every play of every other game throughout the week because I'm concentrating on the Bears. There's just not enough time.
Yeah.
So if you just look at the stats and you just look at the highlights, and there's not many highlights, well, you're going to start to say, well, what's going on with Mitch Trubisky in Chicago? Why is he struggling so much? Why are they holding him back? What's going on? And in reality, we've seen 3 games, and there's really not much to be upset about. He looks like he can play, and if you really evaluate the tape, you see a couple mistakes here and there, but not many. So our frustrations are more, I think, with just the, you know, they're kind of holding him back, and some of that's just human nature from fans that want to see him throw the ball. But I think Trubisky's smart enough to realize that he's not playing all that poorly. And at the same time, you saw him so really hard on himself after the game yesterday. That's kind of just his own, you know, his own attitude that I actually think fans should like, that he's a perfectionist, and he already has the respect from his teammates. So I think they're going to work a lot of this out this week because they know they have to throw the ball against the Saints more.
And the one thing I will say about this, which I think is kind of interesting, and today, you know, at the press conference, I think it was today, John Fox, Coach Fox, talked about the idea, they were referencing a game a while back. They were referencing something against Atlanta and Michael Vick from before in his career. I think it was the game that Chris Winkie started. But this idea of the last time in his career in which there were only seven pass attempts, and he was talking about as a coach of the Carolina Panthers back in the day. And you think about those teams, and you're like, yeah, they had a lot of success almost in spite of their offense. They had a strong defense, and Jake Delhomme would put up mediocre at best numbers. And then when he moved to Denver, we saw the same kind of football with Tim Tebow. The year that Tim Tebow had was under John Fox, and they went 8-8 or 9-7, and they won the West. They won a playoff game. But we played them that year, and I remember being so just unimpressed with what the Denver Broncos were doing. And even to an extent, the reason he got shipped out of town in Denver before they won the Super Bowl was because they wanted to open it up and try something more on offense. This is John Fox. This is what we expected, I guess, from him. We just didn't know it would play out in a way that it's on a team that is mediocre.
Yeah,
if that makes sense, right?
Yeah, no, it does, and it's a great thing to bring up John Fox's history here and some specific examples like you just did. The difference, obviously, is that Trubisky is better than Tim Tebow.
Right.
He's better than Chris Winkie, and they understand that. They know that. It's not like they're worried that Trubisky can't play. I just think they're being careful because he's a rookie and he's only played three games. It's a different situation. That being said, maybe the best part you just brought up was that when they had Peyton Manning, one of the greatest quarterbacks ever, John Elway said, we need a different head coach. We got to open this up a little bit more. And they let Gary Kubiak come in, an offensive guy, and they win a Super Bowl the next year. So that's what I think the big question is at the end of the season. What's best for Mitch Trubisky is maybe developing under John Fox's conservative philosophy right now is okay because it's limiting him from disaster and letting him see defenses and let it come to him as slowly as possible when they didn't even really want him playing at this point. But going forward, once he gets through all that and they feel like they can unleash him more, who should be the head coach? That's the question right now. It's complicated because you also don't want to lose Vic Fangio. You definitely don't want to lose Vic Fangio, and his contract's up at the end of this season, by the way.
773 wants to know about the rookie class. We mentioned about nice transition. Great performances so far this season from the rookies. Eddie Jackson had a historic game yesterday. Tariq Cohen with a big play, 70-some-odd yards on the field. Mitchell Trubisky is a starting quarterback. One guy that's mentioned, 773, what happened to Adam Shaheen? And once again, he's on the field. He had a nice block in one case, but not a target, not involved in this offense. Seems like with an offense that is doesn't have wideouts, that you would find a way to use two tight end sets and get the ball down the seam to Adam Shaheen. What's happening there?
Well, first of all, let me bring up the snap counts here in front of me because it felt like watching the tape that he was playing more. Hang on here. He played 19 snaps on offense, which was 50% of their offensive snaps. So he is getting more playing time, and that is a result, and I've noticed this watching the tape, that his blocking's getting better. And did you see that blindside block he had on Jarius Bird?
Now, don't get me wrong. I thought that would get a flag at 15 yards. I thought the NFL was trying to do away with those blindsides.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a great hit. It was a great classic football hit, but it seemed like a defenseless player.
But it was face-to-face, so as long as...
Is that the rule? Yeah.
I mean, because the guy blocking can't control which direction the safety's head is.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, if he's looking away, that's kind of on the safety. That's not really... If they're face...
It was great. And it also netted about a yard and a half.
Yeah,
Zach Miller didn't really do anything after the block, but I was like, whoa, what a blow! He's down.
Right. But beyond this, that play, I've also noticed at the line of scrimmage, he's blocking better. Opening up they're using him in running plays more, and that's the big thing with him that they needed to see to get him on the field. Obviously, the amount of jumbo sets that they're running and 13 personnel with three tight ends is helping get him on the field too. As far as not catching the ball, here's a couple things. First of all, they're not even trying to throw the ball, so let's factor that in.
Right.
When they do, it's not always going to go to the tight ends. And when they do go to the tight ends, there's still two guys ahead of them in the depth chart, and Deion Sims and Zach Miller, that are going to be the options first. So I wouldn't be too concerned that it has so much to do with Shaheen's development at this point as it does, hey, he's still third on the depth chart, and there's two veterans ahead of him, and they're really not throwing the ball anyway, so there's not a whole lot of targets to go around.
All right, let's get some more questions here. What happened to Marcus Cooper? That's the question. Did he just get outplayed? Is Kyle Fuller now the guy on the corner? Is Marcus Cooper a bench player?
Yeah, I mean, Marcus Cooper had an untimely back injury, and Kyle Fuller took full advantage of it. But remember, Prince Amukamara was dealing with something early in the season, and that allowed Kyle Fuller to be on the field, and Kyle Fuller played so well that when Amukamara came back, remember there was, which game was that? A few weeks ago, they were doing that three-corner rotation. Maybe that was against the Steelers a while back. And then Cooper ends up with his back injury, and Amukamara has been playing really good. They're not even targeting Amukamara very much, which tells you that he's having really good coverage. So sometimes, you know, this just happens in the NFL. It's not really your fault. If a 25-year-old former first-round pick all of a sudden looks like he's really, really good and taking that step forward, well, they're not going to go back to the veteran.
Yeah, right.
And give him his spot back. So it's kind of unfortunate timing for Cooper. I think accurately, he's the third best corner on the team.
No one in Chicago is shedding a tear because he's the guy who returned that blocked field goal and dropped the ball before he got in the end zone. So no one's crying about that.
That's true. That's true.
Offensive line is a question here. What is up with Kyle Long? That's a question that we have. Kyle Long. And the interior line got all of the pressure. They didn't do a great job. The tackles actually held up, as I was looking at the stats. But the interior line of Josh Sitton and Kyle Long and, of course, the center, they didn't do so well.
Yeah, I actually disagree with Pro Football Focus on the I thought Charles Leno gave up one of the sacks. I'm going to have to go back and look at it from the other angle from the end zone. You get a better look at the line play than when you do just from the game broadcast footage. But look, here's the thing about the offensive line as a whole. If you look across the league, offensive line play is kind of a problem. There's not a whole lot of teams that can really say, hey, we have a great offensive line. So I don't think the Bears offensive line compared to the rest of the league is terrible.
Is it because defensive players are getting faster and bigger and they can't keep up or what?
It's a great question.
Blitzes or what?
But it also just seems like offensive linemen aren't as good. So I don't know if there's just that's something I can't answer off the top of my head. I have to really think about that. Is it a lack of prospects coming in from the college level? Is it defensive players just getting faster? You know, you're kind of always at a disadvantage in pass protection as you're backing up, and you got fast athletic guys that have the momentum as they come into you. That's a tough job. So there's some things there that I think have to be looked at. But, you know, in terms of this offensive line, I think the word is consistency that's lacking. Consistency is lacking right now. It seems to be – even Josh Sitton, I thought, struggled. And he's had some really good games, and then he's had a couple games where he struggled like he did yesterday. So and Cody Whitehair, despite the snaps, he's had a lot of really good plays. And then there's also one time I saw yesterday on the film – where he got spun around. So it seems like all five guys are having a tendency to break down at any given time, and just they got to come together as a unit. It also doesn't help, though, when the Panthers, who have a decent defense, are loading up the box in the second half like they did.
I always feel better when I talk to Adam Hoge. There's no doubt about it, because he had to walk me off the winning ledge. They win and I'm down, and then I talk to Adam, I feel better. Prospects of winning three in a row. I mean, going into New Orleans is turning, looking more and more like a possible playoff team. They can score points. What's the keys to the Bears winning in New Orleans?
Well, yeah, and I'd have to go back and double check this. I don't think the Bears have won three games in a row since Mark Trestman's first three games in 2013 when they started 3-0, I think that's correct. So this hasn't been done in a long time. The Saints are 4-2. I mentioned earlier the running game has been impressive so far this season, And their defense, too, has taken a step forward. And much like the Bears, their 2017 draft class looks pretty impressive. They're getting contributions from their rookies. So you're going to see a lot of rookies on the field Sunday that can play football. So this is not an easy game to go into the Superdome. But it's a winnable game. I would say it's a winnable game. And as long as their defense is playing the way it is, they're going to have a chance. Real quick, Saints, bye week, Packers without Aaron Rodgers. Let's see how this looks in a few weeks. I know everyone's frustrated with the offense. Let's just see. Let's let a couple of these games play out.
Why do you got to do that? Why you got to give my hopes up? Now I'm like, I'm starting, they win here and they win here. We might be,
Don't hate winning.
Don't hate winning. That's the takeaway from this week's
segment. Let's go back how we started the hour.
Don't hate winning. All right.
Yeah, that's my advice to you, okay?
Adam Hoge, WGN Radio, covers the Bears. You can find all his great stuff at WGNRadio.com/Bears. Adam, thanks for joining us, man.
All right, thanks, Justin.
All right, learn something there. Don't hate winning. It's my mantra for this week.
Embrace it.
Embrace
both arms. Big winning hug. Come on, bring it in.
I don't know. It's just too many years of Jaron and Lovey. Be like, that was a win. Rex Grossman is our quarterback. You're like, can't we? I'm watching right now Monday Night Football, and the Eagles, Carson Wentz, he just throws the ball around like they're racking up here. What are we doing? All right, don't hate winning. I'm already going back into bad habits. You see that?
Unleash the Kraken, all right? Let Trubisky go. Unleash the Kraken.
Unleash the
Let
Kraken.
Let it go.
That's right. All right, coming up this hour, we're going to talk with Simon Curtis, director, British director of the new film Goodbye, Christopher Robin, which is great. It's really great. It's out in theaters now. Also, Chris Cosentino, the celebrity chef that you can see on Food Network and other places. He's got a new book, Offal Good, Cooking from the Heart with Guts. It's about all of the organ meats that we have left behind as a society and how they're actually good. Get ready for that one.
You ever have tripe?
I haven't.
Don't. Just telling you.
His book is amazing. It's like all of recipes and how to deal with like cutting up sheep's feet. There's feet, it's intestines, it's spleens, stomachs, livers, blood.
Mm-hmm.
All of that stuff. Lungs. You ever had lungs?
No.
There's a lot of that stuff. So anyway, he's a 4-star chef that's cooking up lungs, cow lungs. Oh yeah, yeah. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a celebrity chef and television personality, Chef Chris Cosentino's new book is called Offal Good, Cooking from the Heart with Guts, which could possibly be the best name for a cookbook in the history of cookbooks.
Thank you.
Offal, O-F-F-A-L, is a fancy word for the internal organs in animals, so anything from entrails to the heart to the liver to the tongue to the brain. These variety meats are considered to be the heartier, more flavorful meat, but in many countries around the world, offal's eaten on a regular basis, both in restaurants and in their own kitchens. But in the U.S., we lag behind. The popularity of variety meats has definitely gone way up, but it still seems that Americans are reticent to see organs as a mainstream dish. Enter Cosentino. His book not only talks about the flavors and traditions around the world and the categories of offal, but he sets out to deliver recipes to help you get these meats to the dinner table. Chris Cosentino won Top Chef Masters. He's competed on Iron Chef, and he's a world-renowned chef with the now-closed restaurant Encanto in San Francisco, his new restaurant Coxcomb, which is in San Francisco, and Jackrabbit in Portland. Congratulations. Chef Cosentino, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I know you have such a good answer about the word offal. And it's funny because we call it variety meats, or maybe we call it organ meat here, but offal is a very well-known term in Europe and Asia.
Correct. It's a derivative of the Latin term, offal. So when the animal was harvested, these cuts of meat would fall off the carcass to offal from the carcass.
Good image in your head, sure.
Yeah, I mean, and you think about it, you know, it's bits and bobs, nasty bits, variety meats, offal, umbels, you know, umbel pie came from, those are the same thing. Those are all those cuts.
This kind of food really comes from your time at Alice Waters restaurant.
I learned how to butcher there. So I lied and told a chef at the time that I knew how to butcher, and I broke down two lambs, lying. But, you know, as a young kid growing up in an Italian-American community, my great-grandmother was from Naples, she would cook tripe. And I was, as a young kid, I was horrified. That smell was just scary, you know. You think about it, you talk about going to school, and kids are very influential, you know. Everybody's now talking about bullying. But imagine what it was like as a kid you walk into school and you're like, I had tripe last night. And everybody's like, ew. It's the same thing going on with these kids now. It's like many, many diverse cultures in a school. One kid's eating something that somebody else isn't. And there's peer pressure to not eat those things. So as a kid, it was just stuff that everybody talks about is gross.
Right? Right.
You don't want it. You have a huge butchering community here. You know, I mean, Chicago was the center of it all,
right?
Upton Sinclair, the jungle. Without him, we wouldn't have the regulations that we have now on meat. And this was butcher town. I mean, this was it. There's brains and eggs in there. And the term, you know, hanger steak, which is known as the butcher's cut, is another very specific cut of meat that comes from being, you know, surrounded by butchers. But, you know, those cuts are very special. They're very delicious. It wasn't the moment when I was, you know, I was interning in Chez Panisse for a while, and it was mostly, I think the big change for me personally was, one, as I watched more television about travel in the world, I was seeing these cuts of meat everywhere, and it wasn't really predominant.
It is interesting because Europe, this is seems to be...
the norm.
The norm. Asia, the norm in some ways. There definitely feels a global connection to offal that is not shared here in the Western world.
Well, I mean, I've done all the research, and it took me... The book alone took 10 years. You don't have to yell at anybody to eat a carrot. You kind of have to yell at them to try things they don't feel comfortable with. And, you know, these cuts of meat fell out of favor, right, in the U.S., but they were the norms. And, you know, let's think about it. We are an immigrant country. So with all those immigrants came their culture, their history, and their food. And those food items and all those people that came were mostly peasants. We weren't getting the affluent of all those countries. We were getting the wretched, the poor, right? Just like it says.
Right.
They were bringing with them those historical dishes, whether it be a tripe dish or a pig's foot dish. Mm-hmm. All those dishes were used because it was what they could afford, and it was the right way to do things. They were able to feed more people with less. So just like in Italy, you harvest a hog, you make blood sausage with the blood immediately, you put up the hind legs for ham, you make pâtés, you make rillettes, you eat the organs, and things are readily available for longer periods of time. So the refrigerator is born. We go to war, you know? Let's just break into those things. Like World War II, we had rationing stamps. Everybody talks about rationing stamps. You couldn't buy pantyhose. You couldn't buy sugar. Whole muscle or skeletal muscle cuts were cost almost 3 to 4 times the regular rationing stamps. So if you got meat without joints, which was offal cuts, and that's how they rebranded them, without joints.
Meat without joints.
So if you think about that, it makes sense, right?
Right.
So that's what the norm was for every day. Less amount of rationing stamps, more protein to feed your family. Tripe, for example, has more protein and less fat than a T-bone steak.
But I guess the question is, when did it fall out of favor? I mean, once we got back on, we get the 50s.
So this is where I'm leading you to. So what happens is we end the war. The war is over. We're a prosperous nation. We won the war. We don't have to eat those things anymore. Mm. We're going to eat what we want.
It's almost a status symbol.
It's a status symbol. And then we shifted over. We started agro-farming and really started producing large amounts of cattle in an appropriate way to just get skeletal cuts. And then the world now believes that pigs are centipedes of pork chops draped in bacon running through the farm, which they're ultimately not, you know. And you start looking at what of these cuts is turned into, well, for years it was turned back into animal feed, henceforth BSE. A lot of it was then turned into pet food. And still to date, tons of it is shipped abroad. We're shipping it to the Asias and the Latin Americas. So we're getting rid of it through other means. And it's really sad to think that we could feed. We have so many thousands of people in this country who are starving, who need food. They're one in every six kids.
And there's a sustainability question.
There's a sustainability question. Yeah, you have all these people. Like, think of this. One in every six kids goes to school hungry. This is a way, if we were learned to open our eyes and be a little bit more welcoming of trying something new, we could feed more people.
Does it come down to, in your estimation, as someone who works in offal and has had success in some of the best restaurants in the country, in the world, that it is psychological, that it's some sort of status symbol, that it is we don't really want to get into something we don't know? How much of it is just marketing and psychological as opposed to the taste and whether or not it's easy to make?
I think availability is an issue. These items are extremely perishable, so they're a much smaller cell structure than you would see in a skeletal muscle. So they can't be aged like beef or pork or can be aged, right? Lamb can be aged, but you can't hold on to offal cuts for a longer period of time. There's a textural issue in this country. We have very big issues. What's the number one word used on menus? Crispy.
That's
right?
So true.
Everybody, crispy chicken.
Crispy.
Crispy. Everybody loves crispy. You know, if I put on the menu, jiggly. That's not really hot. Like, you're not running for that, right?
People are lining up
today. We're going to have some jiggly chicken. Everybody's just like, oh, that's nasty. But so it's really embracing texture. And then the flavors can be intense. But what you're getting is an intense flavor, a new texture with the underlying flavor of that same animal. So it's really learning to embrace these cuts in new ways. And you know what? A lot of people have had really bad experiences. Grandma's overcooked liver. Liver and onions, oh, dear God. She cooked it to the death.
Beyond pate and some of the things that you can get in some of the restaurants like yours, you know, frankly, yeah, you get a much different kind of liver experience, right? Yeah. I mean, it's like I think of my dad, and he would make liver, and he'd just be like, I'm not going anywhere near that.
It's when it's overcooked, it's very grainy and chalky. Yeah. When it's cooked properly, and it has a really great palate feel, and I think we've really... Part of understanding it is learning to appreciate the flavors. And I think the way that I approached it from day one, I mean, yes, you know, I thought I knew everything and I was very abrasive and I would try to, you know, cram it on people. But then as time moved forward, I grew up and I really paid attention to what I was doing. I started thinking more about like what makes people feel comfortable, things that are familiar. So you start putting the familiar with the unfamiliar. Bacon with liver. That helps it sell.
Yeah, right.
You know, but then you start doing bacon, liver, balsamic. There you go. Now you got sweet, acidity, smoky bacon. People are like, oh, I might be willing to try that. Don't make it an entree. Make it an appetizer portion. Because then they're not committing to something really big. And it really opens up that conversation.
Smart. Yeah.
But it also creates a situation of conviviality where they're sitting at the table with someone else and they're like, maybe we should try this.
I feel in my life, offal is usually in pates. And I found myself in ways where that now is something. If I see a pate of any sort on any menu, I'm like, oh, I got to have it. So it is presentation, what's paired with things.
Correct.
All right. You talked about the offal and some of those organs and the shelf life being, they're more perishable.
Correct.
The United States government plays a role in this as well as at the USDA. I mean, they look at these hearty meats, these variety meats, as something that really needs to be regulated. I was watching some stuff, some videos where you talk about if you want to get a whole pig that's delivered to a restaurant, that they'll process a lot of that stuff before you even get a chance to get at it. Talk about the role of the USDA when it comes to offal and whether or not it's getting less regulation or more when it comes to trying to get these kind of meats on tables.
Well, if you take a look in the book, you can open up a couple pages in. You'll see an image. That image is from 1928, and it is of an inspector. It's all in black and white. I have a collection of USDA photos from California. And the way it was done is the animal was harvested, and they would have the organs and the animal right in front of each other. So the organs would lie in a tray, and the animal would be in front of it, so they would know which animal it's coming from. That process has since changed since there's not enough inspectors. But any animal that leaves the slaughterhouse does not come with its organs in. It comes with its kidneys, and that's all. Liver, heart, intestines, everything is removed, lungs, some of which is turned into tallow factory, whatever. Mm-hmm. But they separate out the organs piece by piece. They inspect them individually, and they're usually put together in a situation where they're sold in 10-pound increments. Now, a lot of the smaller farmers utilize those organs to pay their slaughter fees. So that's one of the ways that the organs are used. But the inspection process is very interesting. Like, lungs were deemed unfit for human consumption in 1972. Basically, the problem became that people were using them as filler in sausage. And that's where that old horrible saying came from. You know it's in a hot dog. You know it's in a sausage. And that's not the case anymore. You've seen the book and you've looked through it. Everything that I present is presented as what it is.
Yeah.
So I'm not hiding anything. And I think when you buy from reputable purveyors and
like any
ranchers,
situation, whether any situation, it's meat or chicken or poultry,
fish,
right. Fish,
farming,
of course,
you know, anything. Yeah. When you buy and you know it's fresh, you treat it beautifully, right? And I think just like a vegetable, I think a liver or a kidney should be treated with due respect. And I think when you start working with them and you're working with the inspectors, like, I know what they're looking for. They're looking for abscesses. They're looking for cancer lesions. They're looking, because if they find it in that organ, then they're going to check. They check, of course, inspect the animal, but they're looking for things in particular that they feel could be a detriment to human consumption.
And you have recipes in here as well. What are the other barriers for people to get back on the offal train? There's so many ways that you do this. It's not preparation, especially reading these things. It's not like you're having to do any sort of minor surgery to prepare a heart.
It's super simple stuff. So, I mean, I think the easiest entryway for a lot of folks is heart, beef heart. Because beef heart is an... Okay, so there's multiple categories of offal. You have what is known as a cardiac muscle, which is basically blood, heart, and veins, because even the veins move. They pump, right? There's white muscle, and then there's filter muscle. White muscle is intestines, stomach, which would be considered tripe, and then filter muscles, kidneys, thymus gland. Bone marrow is one, because bone marrow produces red blood cells. So you have these different categories they fall in, right? Each one has a different level of intensity for some people. So, for instance, heart, I ultimately think it's a very lean muscle. It's got the highest concentration of creatine, which bodybuilders take every day in a powdered form. And it has no intermuscular fat, zero. It's all external. You always hear those stories like, Uncle Jimmy had to get a stent put in because his arteries were clogged. Well, it's all that stuff clogging on the outside and starting to fill in. So the heart muscle itself, once it's trimmed and cleaned, you remove the arteries from the top and you clean out the inside chambers of the heart. You can grill it like a steak and just slice it. And it's just like a steak. The texture's a little bit, I would say it's a little tougher. And it has a squeak to it when you chew it because the cell wall structure is much smaller. But it's super delicious. And I would get... When I first started serving, you know, these cuts at the restaurant, I had this elderly woman come in for her. She was like in her late 80s, came in, and she was like, this is what beef used to taste like when I was a little girl, young man. And I was like, really? She goes, that's why I like coming here. It makes me feel little again. And it was such a cool experience to hear somebody say that. Right. And I said, well, I don't understand. Well, can you explain to me why? And she said, well, our cattle were older. They worked the farm, or they lived for more than a year. Yeah. Most cattle is a year and a half before.
Yeah, they figured all that out
before it's put down. And she had, you know, she was like, "Yeah, we grew up when cattle were 5, 6, some were 10 years old before they did their work. They were dairy cow, and then they worked the farm. They pulled a plow, and that really made sense because the muscles were moved and worked. And a heart muscle is just it's moving nonstop. Right. It's like the way I explained it to somebody is like when you buy a chicken." Do you just eat the breast and throw away the legs? A lot of people do.
Yeah.
Which is kind of messed up in this world of waste. But the leg meat has more flavor because the chickens run. They're not a flying bird. And there's more blood flow, which builds more myoglobin, which builds more flavor.
We could talk for hours about this stuff. This is great. this is still good. The book is called Offal Good, Cooking from the Heart with Guts. Chef Chris Cosentino is in studio tonight. He won on Top Chef Masters. He competed at Iron Chef. He's also his own chef with the restaurant Encanto, which closed, and which was a huge restaurant in San Francisco, and his new restaurant Coxcomb in San Francisco and Jackrabbit in Portland. Chef, thanks so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
And, no, thank you.
I hope this changes the world, or at least the United States.
We'll try. One plate at a time.
Oh, I don't know about you. Now I'm into some sheep's feet. He was great. Or some cow tongue. My favorite, I was reading the whole chapter on blood. How to cook blood. Liver, of course. Whole thing on fat. Then that's all that. Then there's a section in Chris's book that says, odd parts. That's the next chapter. Udders, testicles, gizzards, the coxcomb. It's a lot of good stuff there. Lips. That is a fascinating history, though, about how our country after World War II was like, no, we're going to change it up, getting rid of all this stuff, you know, but it's still food. We waste it like crazy. All right, coming up, Simon Curtis is going to join us, the director of Goodbye, Christopher Robin, which is in theaters now. a film that looks at the life of A.A. Milne and his son, real-life son Christopher Robin, who really becomes the first current childhood star. Christopher Robin was, of course, the character at the center of the Winnie the Pooh stories. It was based on his son. He was able to take real-life situations of his son and make them the poems that turned into the books of Winnie the Pooh. And at that time, it became biggest. To this date, it's still the number one children's story of all time. And in that time, it was such a fervor for, it was like Harry Potter. It was like that kind of, everyone went crazy for it, that kids wanted to meet the real Christopher Robin. And they would do it over and over and over. They sent him letters, thousands. And he was young, 6 years old, 7 years old, somewhere in there. And the story goes that it ruined his childhood because everything became fake or stunt or PR. And the parents were putting him up saying, you know, well, the real Christopher Robin is going to be at this toy store, or Christopher Robin is going to be over here. And he didn't really know what was happening. There's one shot in the film that's just crazy where he gets a call from his dad, A.A. Milne, is in the States. And he's talking to him and he has a conversation. And then you hear another voice come into the conversation. Go, well, that's all the time we have. There you heard it. A.A. Milne talking to his son, tucking him in at night. Christopher Robin, the real Christopher Robin here on KA670 or whatever. And the torment and the bullying that came from, you know, as he went on and became a teenager and into his life. I mean, it just ruined his childhood. And it's something you don't think about because I'm never attuned to that story. It's a somewhat well-known story in Britain, but not here. I didn't know it. So Simon Curtis, our guest, coming up here after Rob's news. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the new film, Goodbye, Christopher Robin's out in select theaters. It's a film that focuses on the life of famed Winnie the Pooh writer A.A. Milne and his son, Christopher Robin. Of course, Winnie the Pooh was based on Christopher Robin and his stuffed animals, and this film explores the relationship between father and son and the emotional toll the success of Winnie the Pooh had on the real Christopher Robin. In other words, what's it like to have your childhood bought and sold, sharing it with billions of people around the world? The movie is getting great reviews, as it should. The film was directed by Simon Curtis. The British director has several film and television credits on his resume, including producing My Week with Marilyn back in 2011. Goodbye, Christopher Robin is playing all around Chicago, and director Simon Curtis is in studio with me now. Mr. Curtis, thanks for being here.
Delighted to be here.
Fantastic movie. It stuck with me. This story, it's not one that's told, A.A. Milne's story. We know the story. We know Winnie the Pooh. We know all that. But talk about the idea of making a film.
Yeah, I think in America, a lot of people assume in Britain everyone knows this story, but that's not the case. It's an unknown story there, too. Really, unlike my last two films that I sort of pushed into existence, this was a script that came to me. And I loved the fact that, on one level, it took us behind the curtain to show Winnie the Pooh being created by the family that created it. But also, it's about so many other things as well. Most importantly, about family and about fathers and sons.
It's a story I didn't know much about. Of course, Winnie the Pooh is, as you mentioned at the end of the film, one of the most popular, if not the most popular children's book of all time. This film is really about the relationship between A.A. Milne and his son, Christopher Robin, Billy Moon, and how the book actually came out of the real-life story. Talk about that story. Talk about
because what's confusing is that it's not the story of Christopher Robin. We see, and it's, I think, the heart of the film, this idyllic summer in the gorgeous Ashdown Forest, which is south of London. The father and son slowly, almost like falling in love with each other and getting to know each other. And whilst they play these games and we see them inventing the Pooh Sticks game on the actual Pooh Sticks bridge where it actually took place, they also start sharing their imagination and they start playing with the toys, you know, a random bear and a random donkey and so on. And you can almost feel the audience sigh with pleasure when you hear Eeyore given his name or they decide to call Tiger Tigger. So it's definitely that. And then, of course, they couldn't have predicted that these stories would become internationally famous and that would put a lot of pressure on the boy.
And it's amazing to me because it's almost two films in the way that when you get to the point where they are having this idyllic summer and they're falling in love with each other, because up to that point it was kind of a cold relationship.
Well, typical of that class at that time.
Right, of course. And you do feel warm and pleasant, and you do have this this familiarity, of course, as you just mentioned. But then there's the second half of this movie, which is about essentially that childhood, those moments, and Christopher Robin, the actual real-life Christopher Robin, not really being in control of that story, because Milne wrote it, he created all these characters around it, used the boy without, not necessarily permission, it's not like he needed to get a signature, but this idea that his childhood was stolen from him.
Yeah, but again, it was an accident. I mean, they never thought these little stories, these little poems would have the reach they did. And also, they thought, because his name is Christopher Robin, but they didn't call him that. They called him Billy Moon.
That it would protect him, right?
They thought that was a distinction, but the world didn't make that distinction.
What did you know about Milne before you got involved in
this project? Very, very little, actually. And I certainly didn't know that he was a very successful comedy playwright and a comedy writer before the First World War. And I certainly didn't know that he'd had a very difficult, as many, many people did, time fighting in World War One, and then had come back with what we now know to be his PTSD.
The movie does a great job of explaining that and making that a big part of his character. I mean, the reason he is out in the woods south of London, almost finds a healing moment with his son, is because of PTSD. And it is something that never gets talked about when you talk about the World War
I. Yeah, I was very proud that in New York yesterday, a Vietnam vet came up to me after seeing the film and had been deeply moved by it and wanted to show it to all his comrades, you know. And, you know, there are so many great war films. This year we've had Dunkirk, but... Yeah. In its quiet way, I'd like to think this film shows the impact, the lasting impact of war as well. And it's not only on the men and women who fight these wars, but on their spouses at home and their children. And Christopher Robin is a victim of World War I, even though he wasn't born when it ended.
The whole story, and it's beautifully told with Simon Curtis in the film, Goodbye, Christopher Robin. But I mean, that war plays as a central part of this story, and even the relationship, the father and son relationship. Why have war be such a part of a story that's really about Winnie the Pooh and Christopher
Robin's childhood? Well, because Winnie the Pooh was created by a man who was suffering from a trauma based on World War I. And then also, the books became successful so quickly because they enabled readers, first in England and then elsewhere, to reconnect with the innocent, halcyon days before the war took those away.
Yeah, and you do a great job of explaining that, too, that London has a feel, and Milne talked about it, that there's this, the emotion is negative, and that Winnie the Pooh brought positivity or happiness to the fold after World War I.
That's right.
I love the idea that happiness, it served its purpose, meaning that people loved it, like you said, in England and across the world. But then really it's almost juxtaposed with the idea that Christopher Robin's actual happiness changes. As the world's happiness the world becomes happy because of these stories, Christopher Robin's world doesn't.
And that's an irony of the whole story, that they had this wonderful time, created these magical stories that were going to enchant the whole world. And then the fame that those stories brought put them in a very difficult place as a family. However, as you'll see, they come to a nice resolution at the end. And also, a friend of mine went to visit the real Christopher Robin, and he was an older man running a bookshop in West England. And he happily signed his copy of Winnie the Pooh. So I feel that Christopher...
There was some resolution to
this. Yes, correct.
Simon Curtis in studio with me, the director of Goodbye, Christopher Robin, which is out in select theaters in Chicagoland. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk more with the director here in studio. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, Simon Curtis. He is the director of the film Goodbye, Christopher Robin, which is in select theaters now. Great film. Really about A.A. Milne and his relationship with his son, Christopher Robin. Of course, the Winnie the Pooh writer and subject, Christopher Robin. I have so many questions about childhood. Really stuck with me, this movie. But this is a period piece. This takes place in the 20s. Talk about do you like doing these kind of films when you get to travel back in history and create time and place again?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yes, I do, is the short answer. But I didn't seek out, let's do a film set in the 20s. Yeah. I just really like this script, you know, and I liked the fact that you show the creation of this book, but it also examines so many other things that are relevant today, like we're portraying actually the first ever child celebrity and the impact fame has on him. And also, as I say, there aren't that many films about fathers and sons. Mm. And I've been very pleased that, as well as hearing a lot of laughter at the screenings we've had all over the place, I also hear a lot of sniffles, not least from men. And someone said it's very unusual for men to have a little cry.
There is the paparazzi kind of element. When the book takes off and Christopher Robin is almost forced to promote the book. I mean, that's what they're doing. Yeah. They're unbeknownst to him. The parents are saying, hey, get out there, you know.
Yeah.
It's just this startling idea that this concept of chasing fame or trying to get people to sign autographs, whatever it might be, in the 20s is very similar to people standing outside of airports in 2017. Yeah. It's very, that I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, but to be fair, the parents couldn't have predicted this because it had never happened before. And the fame was really unusual. But I think slowly they understand the impact it's having on him. Yeah, certainly the father does.
Definitely a point there. Do you want to go out of your way to make sure that there is fairness to A.A. Milne and his wife? Because they do come across, because they are selling a book and this is happening. I mean, there's some tender moments in the film that you find out are staged because the parents are doing that for promotional opportunity.
Just one of those.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like you seem to be reticent to point them and put them in that box.
Because, I mean, I think I had two brilliant actors we have mentioned, Donald Gleeson and Margot Robbie.
They did a great job.
And they knew they were playing characters of a certain time, of a certain class. And it would have been wrong for them to be all sort of cozy and, like, say, modern parents. And interestingly, Daphne, Margot's character, is in Christopher later in life said that he only saw his mother for sort of half an hour before bed or maybe half an hour after breakfast, but during those 2 half hours she was totally there for him. And we see her give him the famous toys that starts it all. We see her invent the voices. We see the love and the pleasure in her face at certain times, but she thinks it's okay to hand the kid to a nanny because that's what they did then. And a whole generation of English men were brought up by their nannies and then kicked off to boarding school. And you could argue that's why England is the country it is, and not in a good way.
I really love the period piece of it, and you did such a good job of depicting 1920s London and south of London. I really enjoyed it because of the relationships. And you mentioned just a second ago the idea of this being almost the precedent for childhood stardom. And we see this a lot in our society where someone is a star on a TV show when they're 8 years old and as they become an adult, that childhood is, because it was taken from them or shared, they have a hard time adjusting. And Christopher Robin in this film, that's sort of what's happening here. The world around him knows almost more about him than he does. Talk about trying to unlock that recipe, that how important childhood is to us as adults.
I would say that one of the great themes of this film is pay attention to your children or to your parents while they're around, because the nanny says you never know what happens next. Mm-hmm. And you look around and on the subway you just see a family all looking at their separate phones or in a restaurant. And I want to say, hopefully those kids won't go to war, but they will go somewhere. So cherish them while you've got them. Yeah. And I think that's a very important modern theme.
And in this case, what I thought to be interesting was that Christopher Robin, he had to deal with the fame. Meaning when he went to prep school and he went on, even as they tried to shut it down.
It got
away from them. He had to continually deal with it. And talk about that, because that's something I think that as we talk about what the relationship between childhood and adulthood, this idea that fame was great for him. People are like, oh, Christopher Robin. I think there's even points where like Christopher Robin must be living the life.
Yeah.
And he's not, because everybody around him has taken pieces of him.
Yeah.
He doesn't even know it.
I know. And it's definitely a mixed bag. You know, the last 9-year-old boy I cast who'd never acted before was Daniel Radcliffe, and he's gone on to play Harry Potter, obviously. So I've watched that, and you know, he's got from a very lovely family and is a most lovely young man now. And Will, who plays Christopher Robin, is also from a great family, and who knows whether he'll go on to act or just go back to school. But he's a special boy, and I wish him, you know, good wishes.
We mentioned the actors, and the actors are great in this film. And you, I've read a couple things about you today that really is your strength, of being able to pull these roles out of the actors, and especially when you're talking about time periods and playing a certain class in the 20s, and even trying to emotionally soften them so that they don't come across so hard, but also be true to the time. Mm-hmm. How do you do that? How important is that for you as a director to get that right?
I mean, that's the job in a way. And you don't ever know. I mean, you always learn about a film when you see it for the first time. And so what I try and do is to cast the best people and then support them to do their best work. and give ourselves as many options as possible so we can tweak it in the cutting room.
My final question, just about Winnie the Pooh, which is really, you know, we haven't even talked about that, the story that really has sparked this entire story. Do you look at it differently now? After going through this whole process and learning about Milne and filming this, do you look at the story of Winnie Pooh?
I go back and think, oh, I wonder how that idea came about and what game triggered that or whatever. But, you know, I love the Winnie the Pooh stories. And obviously, they've got a lot of fans all over the world. And I hope they'll come and see the film because, you know, even though there's quite a mixture of emotions in it, there is so much sort of joy and happiness and laughter as well as tears.
Simon Curtis is the director of Goodbye, Christopher Robin, which is in select theaters in Chicago. I can't thank you enough for coming in.
Really, my pleasure. And thank
and
you very
congrats
much.
Congrats on a great film.
I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Download here, 720 WGN. Coming up, Studio 435 live. In studio tonight, Star Tropics. They, a dream pop band from Chicago. They just put out their full-length album, which was called Lost World, this summer. And they're playing at Shuba's. They got another show coming up this weekend. But great to have them in studio, getting set up here. I'm excited to have... I love it. I love the studio. It's transformed. You know, it almost becomes like an MTV Unplugged, if you remember that set. It's a lot like that, but still a lot of Dell computer screens everywhere. You know, a couple of small TVs.
Get some more candles.
I know, we need some candles. I always think about that show, and the only one I ever remember is Nirvana. That's like all of them, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's probably like 50 bands, but we'll always remember that one because they played it in heavy rotation. Yeah. All right, so that's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour tonight. Tomorrow we got a show. We're only on till, what, 8:30? That's when the pregame for the Hawks playing out in Vegas. But we'll have Frank Grillo on the show. Frank Grillo, an action star. He's got a new show, a new movie, actually. Wheelman on Netflix. It's on right now, so you can check it out. So we'll talk with him. Also talk with the CEO and founder of Epic Burger. Be our guest on Download in Chicago Business. So that's tomorrow. And then we got a great show Wednesday. I'm so excited. This week's great. Wednesday, Ted Leo. Musician Ted Leo. How great is that? Ted Leo and the Pharmacists, great indie rock band. Ted Leo will be my guest. We'll talk about music, life, indie rock, all that kind of stuff thrown in. So a lot to do this week. That's just the Wednesday. Don't even get me started on Thursday.
Yeah, we got a full week almost.
I know. We got the Blackhawks tomorrow, and then we got Blackhawks Friday, too. You know, it's also this week is the beginning of me getting back into the slow cooking. I if you are listening to this show, you know that I was really getting obsessed with the slow cooker.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really bad at it. Like, I made like a heart healthy 5-way chili today. And I was all excited about it. I was like, oh, this is good, but it's so low fat across the board that it tastes like nothing.
Yeah. You lost me at heart healthy.
Yeah. I was like, this is the start of a new heart healthy Justin. And I don't know, man. I just feel like, and whenever my wife does it, she's like, she just does it by hand. She's a little sprinkle of this, a little allspice. So we put a little this in here, a little cumin.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting there going, you know, like measuring it out in the teaspoon, like my life depended on it. And if some sneaks over and it gets in there, I'm like, oh, God, what did I do? I ruined the pH of this dish. And I just ruin it. I get it cooked up. It smells great. And then you're like, well, that didn't taste right. It never tastes right. That's Justin Kaufman. Never tastes right.
Yeah, it's more salt.
I think that's what I have to do. I'm not going to give up, but I'm getting close to giving up.
America's Test Kitchen.
Yeah, right?
That's follow them and you won't go wrong.
Really? Or do I just maybe hire, can you hire a, what's the going rate on hiring a chef? Is that a thing? Can I just hire a chef?
Downloads personal chef?
Yeah, like downloads personal chef who just hangs out. I'm like, I think I want a striped bass. And they make it? That's not a thing? It seems like a thing.
If you're Oprah.
Yeah, that's yeah, see those shows, Lifestyles of Rich and Famous?
And it's a thing, but...
It's a thing.
Costs sure money.
It's my thing, right? Yeah. Well, someday, right? Thanks, Rob. It is the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer, right here in our Allstate Showcase studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. We transformed the studio into a performance space, thanks to Bob Ferguson for that. Tonight, the dream pop sounds of Chicago's Star Tropics. Star Tropics have an album out called Lost World. They put it out earlier this year, this summer. It's their first full-length album. They'll be playing tomorrow night at Shuba's on the north side. And they're also going to get out to Logan Square this weekend. We'll talk about that. Star Tropics is Scott Hibbetts, Lauren Vanderbilt III, and Molly Cleary. They're getting help tonight from Vin Santiago as well. You guys, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
So let's get into dream pop. I'm so curious about this sound because we've had dream pop bands in before, and whenever we have these conversations, I like to dig deep on the music because when I hear it, I hear an ode to an 80s. Like, I know that it kind of comes from you guys all coming together because of the Smiths, but talk about what dream pop, what is dream pop?
Well, the basis of dream pop really happened in like the late 80s to the early 90s. It's a throwback to that sound. It wasn't necessarily super popular in the United States, but in the UK, a lot of those bands were are good examples of that sound.
Yeah, tell me the bands. Like, what are we talking about? Like, the Smiths would be, I guess that would be one, but they're a little bit more pop.
Yeah, Smiths are a little bit more indie pop. We're talking stuff more like Cocteau Twins.
Yeah, right on.
Good Lush. Stuff
like that. Lush.
Yeah.
Ride.
I love it. I could do it all night. Let's keep going.
I mean, like, some people would even consider some of the Cure's output a little dream pop, but probably not all of it, because there are a lot of their stuff is post-punky, too.
Yeah. When you talk about those bands, and you're right, there was a real British movement for it. I mean, there are bands out there. I mean, when you talk about it coming to the States and becoming popular, I think about even my – I mean, you date me. That was my college experience. That's when I was in college, those bands, Ride and Lush and those kind of dream pop bands. But since that time, where has the genre gone? I mean, because I think about those – and there's always – you'll harken back to that romantic period in which – you just mentioned like the early 90s, but how has the music evolved? Here we are in 2017. You guys are you playing a throwback music or has this genre evolved?
I mean, I think there's a throwback element to it for sure. I mean, even a lot of those earlier dream pop bands, like when it was first becoming popular, a lot of them considered their music a little bit of a throwback, not in aesthetic, but in the style of writing, like a throwback to like 60s songwriting, just classic pop guitar music. I'm sure a lot of those bands listened to like Ray Davies and the Beach Boys and like copied those kind of song structures. So, you know, I would say there's a little bit of that in us too, but
yeah, that's fair.
I think we're in a small handful of people in Chicago too. There's not.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Like, I mean, locally, when you think about what Chicago puts out, especially when it comes to a more indie rock sound, you're not getting a ton of dream pop, but you will get a lot of bands. I mean, there's a lot of bands that'll come through that are playing. I think of Twin Peaks as a band that'll harken back to a 60s style of music, or maybe even we've had a lot of the bands in here that are kind of breaking from Chicago. They're not dream pop, but they're definitely harkening back to a different era and being able to modernize it. Yeah. Where does the dream pop band, where is that scene in Chicago? Are there other bands like you? Are you guys it? Are you guys bringing the Cocteau Twins back from the dead here?
There's a few others. And we definitely are close-knit. Our friends Panda Riot, who were also on your show.
Yeah, love them.
Yeah, they're fantastic. They're great friends of ours. Their guitarist, Brian, has actually recorded every single thing we've released. So he's been super cool to work with. And you know, there's like shoegaze bands, which is not quite dream pop, but they're like siblings. So bands like Ariel, Light Foils, there are like similar kin of bands around.
What would be the difference? What's the difference between, I always get confused. I mean, you're talking to old man Kaufman here in the way that like the idea of shoegaze versus dream pop. I mean, is there a distinction between those two types of music?
Crossover.
Yeah, there's so much crossover that it really depends on who you ask. Because, I mean, like, for instance, those classic bands, like with Ride, some people consider them a dream pop band. Some people consider them shoegaze. Mm-hmm. You know, it's...
People get picky about it, too.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, I personally, in my personal definition of like shoegaze is probably just more technical, maybe.
Okay.
And then dream pop is more focused on like the poppiness of it. Yeah. But both of those bands, both types of bands, are using all the effects, similar effects pedals, and
I mean a lot of the music when I think of dream pop, I do think of this driving guitar, almost this circular loud guitar that almost overpowers the lyrics. I mean, when mm-hmm. I think about that has been the hallmark of that music. When you talk about the technical aspects of dream pop, it really is this it comes out of the UK, and this idea of this driving, almost melodic but circular guitar sound. Talk about that as musicians, as guys that have come up through this. Is that something that defines the music, but also is something that draws you in, that sound, that guitar sound?
Oh yeah, definitely. I would say for us though, it's a little bit more simplistic than that. Like our songs, we don't typically have that many layers of guitars, mm-hmm. but it definitely draws from that idea of like circular patterns and doing these like effect spirals and playing just within that style.
Yeah, right. Do you guys, and when I think about where the music has evolved, where dream pop, the genre has evolved, I mean, with the advent of streaming sites like Spotify and Apple and other places, I mean, you can go and get that stuff. I mean, I can put right. that in heavy rotation. That music has found a place. No longer you got to dust off the old 7-inch or the CD to listen to a Ride or a Lush. Is that that's a good thing. That's a good thing for the genre. It's a good thing for you guys that there are even some of the old bands can be your contemporaries.
Yeah, I feel like I would imagine it's much more accessible now than it would have been even a few years ago, honestly. Like, I think I end up getting into different bands through, like, YouTube even. And just, like, I don't know. I think every different streaming service has, like, just that radio feature where you mm-hmm. can just discover the new bands through that. But yeah, I think I use those a lot. And I think that's how people discover us, too. So. Mm-hmm.
The band Star Tropics in studio, Chicago's dream pop band. There's a couple others, but Panda Riot too. And we'll talk about. I want to learn more about your recording process and also your writing process when you are taking a more simplistic approach to a music that's heavy with the layering, especially when it comes to recording. Star Tropics are in studio at 4:35 tonight. They're about to play live. They're going to be at Shuba's tomorrow night, which is yeah. great. And then you're going to be also in Logan Square this weekend. We'll talk about that. Star Tropics is Scott Hibbets, Lauren Vanderbilt III, and Molly Cleary. They're getting help tonight. Vin Santiago's here as well. All right, so let's do this. We'll take a quick break. We'll get a quick sound check, and we will get these guys up and running. Star Tropics in Studio 435 tonight. Stay with us. Play ball, celebrate the Cubs with team memorabilia, exclusive books, and so much more. Visit ChicagoTribuneStore.com today. It is Studio 435 here, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer right here on the download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio tonight. The dream pop sounds of Chicago's Star Tropics. Star Tropics has an album out called Lost World. They're going to be playing tomorrow at Shuba's on the north side. They are Scott Hibbets, Lauren Vanderbilt III, and Molly Cleary, also helping out tonight, Vin Santiago on guitar. All right, so here they are in Studio 435. Let's get some live music. Here's a track, Another Sunny Day. Take it away, guys.
Time. Just ends. I will be the one to show you out the door, cause I don't love you. I can tell you've been around, I'm chasing you all over town. Thought I heard you call for me, it's just a distant memory. So tonight, shut your eyes, think of me in brighter skies. You and I will meet another time, another time.
Go! Hey, I love it. There's a little reverb on the voice. I'll take it. All right. There we are. Star Tropics in studio 435 tonight. They are Scott Hibbetts, Lauren Vanderbilt III, Molly Cleary, also Vin Sandiero helping out tonight. Why don't you guys come on over to the seats? I think what I'll do here is I'll probably take a break and get the update from tonight's news, and then we will continue the conversation. But Star Tropics, they got a new album out called Lost World, which was just put out earlier this year. This was the track Another Sunny Day. That's what we just heard. This was their first full-length album, and I'm looking forward to having the conversation about putting that together. You can obviously hear the layers in what you guys are doing, which is so fun. Star Tropics in Studio 435 tonight. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get the update from Rob on the news, and then we'll continue our conversation with the band. Stay with us. All right, welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time for Studio 435, the second half, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer. Tonight, Chicago Star Tropics. They got an album out called Lost World, their first full length. We're going to talk about it in just a second. But first, we'll hear some live music. They're going to be playing at Shuba's on the north side tomorrow night. Star Tropics is Scott Hibbetts, Lauren Vanderbilt III, and Molly Cleary, also helped from Vin Sandiego. Here is that title track, Lost World, Studio 435. Take it away, guys. Wait, we'll dream in the sun, just stay beside. Our Tropics. Live in Studio 435 tonight here on 720 WGN. Come around the table, you guys. Scott Hibbetts, Lauren Vanderbilt III, Molly Cleary, also Vin Santiago on that track. Lost World was the name of the song, which is also the name of the first feature-length album that they've put out, Lost World. They're going to be playing at Shuba's tomorrow night and up there on Belmont. They also got a gig coming up here in Logan Square. We'll talk about that song. I mean, that's dream pop, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's really interesting because I know the sound so much. Like, I know it. I mean, it's ingrained in musician. Like, anyone who likes music, you know that sound. And it's interesting that that sound is one that harkens back to a certain time, but
really
at the same
specific,
time, yeah, it's very specific. Like it really kind of pulls emotion from you guys. What is it about this that attracts you as musicians? What is it about this form and this style of music that you keep coming back to?
It's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it for me too. It's just so pretty sounding.
I think I kind of began as a more of a shoegaze fan, and you know, through meeting these guys, I think I've maybe expanded to more dream pop, but I think you guys are the experts.
I don't know about that, yeah. But I mean, I think everything, it just always comes down to, as an artist, like what you're attracted to, and there's just something about the aesthetic that I always thought was so pretty, that the music I started to make when I started to write music just sort of sounded like this, and I mean, I think we're doing an okay job.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the music, because Lost World, the album, this is your first album that you put out. You put out music before, but this is the first mm-hmm. full length. Talk about that process. I mean, is this when you're going out and you're putting out the first album? What goes into that?
I mean, it was such a long process. Yeah. We've been together the band started, I should say, about 5.5 years ago at this point. And so, you know, maybe some bands would have an album out sooner than that, but we really took our time. And
why?
I think when I first came into the picture, you guys kind of explained it to me as like everything that could have gone wrong went wrong in the process.
Yeah.
And like you even said, you were like, it was like a year long anxiety attack.
Trying to figure out what was holding you guys back?
You know, I think, you know, we just didn't really know what we were doing. And some bands, I think, are lucky enough that when they try things on the first shot, it just works out really well. I don't necessarily think we were lucky in that regard. In other regards, we've been very lucky.
Are you a band that was first found itself on stage, trying some of this music and writing music to stage? Or were you a band that was first in the studio that was like, or in the rehearsal room?
I would say in the basement.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Specifically in my old basement. We, you know, put sheets up on the walls so that way the sound didn't come back at us too harshly. And we would just play in the basement when me and Scott met, and we just started jamming, and that's how the song started to get written. And yeah, that's basically the origin.
What goes into that? I mean, when you're putting a band together like that and you're playing in the basement, I have this problem. Even this problem is just in the show sometimes when I want to get people together. It takes some time. There's schedules. There's things move around. You want to go faster. You want to go slower. Well, talk about the discipline and what it takes to be a band in Chicago. I mean, how often are you guys in that basement? Just take us back to those times where you're trying to figure it out. I mean, this is something that I would assume you guys are in there more often than you wanted to be.
We've Definitely. Moved on from the basement.
Yeah. No longer in the basement for sure, but I mean, that was part of the band originally, like just to have the discipline to keep going. When I went to school at the Art Institute of Chicago, and you know, it was a very great school, but one of the best things I ever learned was from a teacher that wrote down these instructions on a napkin for me. Her name was Anna Kunz, and she taught color theory. I don't know if she's still there.
Shout out.
Right? She said, if you want to be successful, you have to be like these three things. And she wrote tenacity, discipline, and of course, I can't think of the other one. But I still have that napkin. And that's like
great,
that's like one of the that's greatest awesome. Lessons that I took from that school. Was just that simple thing. And so, you know, I applied a lot of the stuff that I learned in the visual art field to the music. And the discipline, though, was, like, very, very important.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, we have all the bands that come through Studio 435, and I'm always amazed at discipline, but also the approach, because people are they're dedicating their artistic lives to this. They may have other things going on, and we've had people conversations about, you know, well, when the band gets older and there's families, or when work gets in the way of touring, there's been conversations. But the one thing that always it comes back to is the tenacity and the discipline of wanting to execute your artistic vision. And at a certain point, that separates the wheat from the chaff. I mean, at a certain point, that's what makes a band a band.
Yeah.
The idea that you're not giving up, that you're putting in the time, that you're executing the vision. Because anybody, how many times people say, oh, guy, you know what would be a great, you know what would be a great, I'd love to do a radio show. You know what would be great? To do this. Oh, you know what would be great? Yeah. I got this great idea for a TV show. Well, there's a big difference between the idea of a TV show and actually executing and getting it on TV. So, do you guys agree, like as a band in Chicago, how much it actually takes to execute the thing?
Oh, definitely. It's a huge pain. it requires so much patience to do anything.
Yeah.
I know. I don't think all bands practice, you know, weekly, regularly, and that's something that we definitely do. And I feel like that definitely keeps our sound tight.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would say. I mean, it's a commitment, definitely, scheduling and everything, but I think we all are committed and we have a big interest in this. So,
yeah. I mean, not only internally, but just put in the work just to make your band like sort of exist. You know, there's the internal stuff where you're putting in the discipline to work on the songs and practice, but then like to put yourself out there and to exist in this world that doesn't really even know what dream pop is, or like, mm-hmm. yeah, like there's so many bands in Chicago there's a huge diversity of bands in Chicago. But as far as dream pop, it's so small that like, if we stopped playing out or if we stopped trying, we would disappear pretty quickly, yeah. Probably.
Is it hard for you guys to gig that way? I mean, because a lot of times they'll group up. If there's a hip hop show, it'll be all hip hop shows. You know, right. If it's a rock show, I mean, can you play on different bills? I mean, because of the dream pop, you can play in a rock show or an indie rock show, or talk about where do you fit in you're doing dream pop?
We definitely try to like get onto bills that are similar bands for sure. I mean, we've definitely played with some Chicago garage bands because it's hard to avoid that. Garage, for those that don't know, is like super popular amongst the Chicago scene, especially the DIY scene.
Really?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Like,
and what is, I mean, so that, when you say the DIY scene, that's house shows, things like that?
Yeah. Yeah. Basement shows and stuff like that. I mean, like that's pretty much ruled by the garage sound for sure.
And what what classifies a garage sound?
I would just
loud.
Not only loud. I mean, I feel like just describing it as loud is doing it a disservice, because there's some great songwriting going into those bands. I mean, like, I would classify a popular Chicago band like Twin Peaks to be garage.
Yeah.
Right. You know, of course, they're not DIY anymore. They're doing right, national, right.
But they came out of that scene. That's when they're on the show, that's what they talked about, playing house shows, things like that.
A lot of bands are of similar ilk, and, you know, they are really super talented, and they've really nailed that aesthetic down. We don't necessarily fit in with that scene, but, you know, sometimes we'll play shows with those bands too.
Do you not fit in because that's not the kind of music that a house audience thinks they're going to get? The idea, you know, like, I mean, what do you mean? Or is it personality driven? Like, I mean,
no,
I think it's just purely aesthetic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I mean, like we have friends in all sorts of bands that are, you know, super different than us. I don't think that would stop us.
I ask these questions. I'm intrigued. Old man Kaufman. I'm fascinated by the idea of the DIY scene. Mm-hmm. And as you just tip me off to, I feel like every time I do a Studio 435, I learn more about the Chicago music scene.
Oh.
But the idea that this town is driven by the garage sound is something I haven't heard before.
Oh,
but it does make sense with the idea that there is so much happening that aren't in the clubs that you're using. I mean, you're playing Shubas tomorrow, which is great. That's a established venue, and a lot of bands come through there, but
yeah,
a lot of the heart and soul of indie rock and the bands that you're talking about, they're happening in basements and second floors and other places around Chicago and the suburbs that a lot of people just don't even know exists.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you got to be attuned to it, but I mean, like, some of these bands are really blowing up, like Knee High is another local band are incredible.
Yeah. They're great.
They're so good. And, you know, there's bands from the suburbs, too, like the Orwells. They're sort of garagey, I would consider them. And they've of course, I mean, they've played Letterman. They're so whatever.
So what's the plan for you guys? I mean, I'm as you find a footing in Chicago's dream pop. There's not a lot of dream pop, right? But I mean, is the plan to get outside of the city? Is it the idea of getting on tour to tap into a dream pop scene that is nationwide? I mean, because again, these are popular. This is a popular genre of music that has kind of gone by the wayside. But at the same time, I would assume there's a lot of people out there that want to hear it.
We went to St. Louis like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, St. Louis loves it.
They were down. Yeah, they were cool.
So I think like if we get paired with other bands that are similar in other places, we're definitely willing to go, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we want to take it as far as it can go.
Yeah.
One of the earliest things we did in the band was play New York City. We played the Pop Fest there. We'd love to do it again if they're listening.
Didn't somebody ask us to come to Norway next summer or something too?
Possibly. I don't know what you're talking about, Molly.
Oops.
Well, the band in studio Star Tropics, we're talking about, they got a show coming up here at Shubas tomorrow night, right on the north side there in Belmont. And they got a show in Logan Square coming up, and this is a venue. What's the venue?
East Room.
And that's new. I didn't even know about that place.
It's a relatively new bar. I think they keep a low profile. It may be considered, like, because you have to, like, go in through the back door as well. It's sort of their thing.
You classic dream pop. Classic dream pop right there. But you guys, continued success in playing, and I know you've got a lot of stuff coming up here. Lost World came out this summer. How does it work? You tour it, and then when do you start thinking about the next project?
We're already thinking about the next, because, I mean, as you've heard in the live performance, Molly is our new singer. She's very recent to the band. She's played a few shows with us. We're really excited, and we want people to hear her. So we've got some new songs written, and we're hoping to go into the studio to record one or two songs in the next couple weeks.
All right, there you go. Star Tropics in Studio 435 tonight. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and we will get our last live song from the dream pop sensation Star Tropics. Stay
Thank
with
you.
Us. We're wrapping up Studio 435 tonight with Chicago Star Tropics. Their album Lost World is out. They're playing Shubas tomorrow night. They are Scott Hibbets, Lauren Vanderbilt III, and Molly Cleary, also helping out tonight, Vin Santiago on guitar. They are in studio, and they're ready for their final song here in Studio 435. It's called Swept Away. Take it away.
Swept away forever.
the same dream every night. I just wanna see the sunrise. I just wanna look into your eyes. And when those winds blow outside my window, I can't seem to understand. How did you slip out of my hand? So hold me close to you, and you're the only one who makes me feel this way. It's swept away forever and a day.
Yeah. There we go. Yes, in studio. Star Tropic, Chicago's dream pop band. I mean, Panda Riot, of course. Both of the bands. The album is called Lost World. It is out. It was out this summer. They're working on new material. Star Tropics is Scott Hibbett, Lauren Vanderbilt III, and Molly Cleary. Also, thanks to Vin Santiago for helping out tonight. Also, thanks to Bob Ferguson for the mix. Star Tropics, you can find all their stuff online through all the streaming sites, and they're going to be playing at Shuba's tomorrow night on the North Side, and then again, Logan Square this weekend. Guys, thanks so much for being here. Really appreciate it. Thanks for being a guest in Studio 435.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
All right, that's going to do it tonight for the download. We'll be back tomorrow for a very short show until 8:30. Like I said, Frank Grillo is going to be here. Action star from the new Netflix. He's been Captain America. He was in a bunch of stuff, but he's in a new Netflix movie, Wheelman. So that's coming up tomorrow, Frank Grillo. Be on the show. Patty Vasquez up next. Hi, Patty. How
Hello.
Are you?
Hello. I'm good.
Good to see you.
Just sit around on stair climbing, by the way. I'm getting ready for the fight paracline.
You're way ahead.
You ready to train? You ready to train? Come on.
I'm not ready to train.
Just
I feel like that's a winter
right
thing.
It is, but that's why when the weather gets chilly like this, perfect time to be in the stairwells. Skip the elevator, take
I
the
love
stairs.
It. I mean, there's nothing better than training for the stair climb.
The fight for air climb coming. It's not till March, I know.
They make it's them. Not till March. You're going to run this thing like 12 times over. You're going to do like 6,000 stairs.
It's just the easiest thing. I don't like to run. I like stairs because I know where my destination is. The stairwell ends, I'm done with the workout.
I procrastinate and I start to train up about a couple weeks before, like a week before, and then I'm like, all right, I'm going to die.
But no,
I make
but
it
you
through.
Always do fine.
I make it through.
There's
it's
something
fine,
about that day of, isn't there?
Yeah,
the adrenaline,
it's the adrenaline
and everything.
Of it. Yeah,
it's really
awesome.
Good.
Awesome. Yeah. What's on the show tonight?
We have comedian Paul Farvar coming in, Esquire. We also have Mona, who's got some great shows at the, what's that bowling alley on Diversity? Diversity Bowl.
Yeah, Rockin' Bowl, right?
Yeah, they've got comedy and trivia twice a month, so
oh,
it's a lot of
cool.
fun. We also, is Prosecco coming in? They're celebrating their anniversary. Adam Selzer's going to be here. He does a lot of ghost tours around
yeah,
the city,
yeah,
so
yeah,
perfect
right
time
on.
For him.
Yeah.
And then we're going to find out what Paul is eating, and you'll have to listen to find out what that means.
All right, sounds good.
All right, have a great night, Justin and Pete.
Thank you.